Good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, January 16, 2017. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 712-770-4160. Our participant code is 385698. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send questions to questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. That's questions, plural, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right. Okay, tonight's scripture we're going to read is in the Gospel of John, chapter 10. Read about 18 verses on the Good Shepherd. John, chapter 10. Truly, truly, I say unto you, he that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbeth up some other way, the same is as a thief and a robber. But he that entereth in by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the porter openeth, and the sheep heareth his voice, and he calleth his own sheep by name, and leadeth them out. And when he putteth forth his own sheep, he goeth before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice, and a stranger will they not follow, but will flee from him, for they know not the voice of the strangers. This parable spake Jesus unto them, but they understood not those things that they which he spake unto them. Then Jesus said unto them again, truly, truly, I say unto you, I am the door of the sheep. All that ever come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. The thief cometh not but for to steal, and to kill, and to destroy. I am come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd giveth his life for his sheep. But he that is a hireling, and not a shepherd, whose own the sheep are not, seeth the wolf cometh, and leaveth the sheep, and fleeth, and the wolf catcheth them, and scattereth the sheep. The hireling fleeth because he is a hireling, and careth not for the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and know my sheep, and have known of mine. As the Father knoweth me, even so know I the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. And other sheep I have, which are not of this fold, them also I must bring, and they shall hear my voice, and there shall be one fold and one shepherd. Therefore doeth my Father love me, because I lay down my life, that I might take it again. No man taketh from me, but I lay it down myself. I have power to lay it down, I have the power to take it up again. This commandment have I received from my Father. All right, that was John chapter 10 on the Good Shepherd. Okay, let's see. I guess we're going to go straight to questions right now first. Jen, do we have any questions?
Yes, we have several questions and an announcement or two. First question is, why does NLA need to serve a competent party like a senator or judge or clerk or attorney?
I'm not sure what he means, serving in a court. Why do we have to serve them?
I assume it's like for the case we filed in New York, have to serve the people.
Okay. Yeah, well, we're not getting anywhere anyplace else, so we have to take it to a place where they can't not argue with us or can't not debate or respond, and that would be through a court case. And, of course, we've written this court case in a very controlled fashion, and we've been very, very careful of our language, and we've put everything together in a very careful way. As a matter of fact, what people might want to read, let me open up the docket page on a website, nationallibertyalliance.org/docket. Or you can highlight grand jury and come down and click on the docket. One of the papers that I'm not even sure whether we read this paper or not. I got to look back to see if we read this paper. But there is a paper where we laid out the process by which we're going forward with the court. And that is, let's see, where is this one? Statement of jurisdiction, judicial notice to magistrate. When did we write that one, Jan? Do you know if we read that one?
I don't believe we did yet.
Okay, we may read that. Maybe we'll read that tonight. It's only a few pages. It's a very important paper. It lays out the process by which we are going into the courts. Maybe while I'm doing this, you could take a quick look onto our recording page, you know, with the weekly call page.
What was the number? And, what's the number on that one, John?
It's number, let's see, judicial notice to magistrate. I changed it to 1005, and it's judicial notice to magistrate. You might see something, titled on one of the weekly programs. It would be in the last 2 weeks or so because we just recently wrote that. So, but anyway, this lays out the process of how we're going into this court and how we expect these people to behave under the process of common law, you know. So why do we have to serve a senator or a congressman? Well, we're serving them with papers so that they might answer. And we're making it clear to them, and we're going to make it clear. We're also going to make it clear to the United States attorney that he's not welcome to come in to defend any of these people. We're going to copy him all the papers that we put in. The rules of the court require that. I think to some degree that's repugnant, at least in this case, because we don't want them to respond on behalf of these people. These are elected individuals. They have a duty to speak. So when they're asked the question, they must speak. If they don't want to speak, they can resign their office. Maybe they don't want to speak because they're committing a crime or something. And if we discover the crime, we'll convict them of that crime. But the bottom line is when you have a duty to speak and you remain silent, that's fraud. And that's the point we make in our case. So, I was going to mail these out today. I forgot that today was a holiday, but we are mailing out all of the served papers tomorrow. They're all done, sitting on the desk here, ready to go out. We're serving all eight justices up there at the United States Supreme Court. There's only eight up there right now with Scalia gone. We are serving President-elect Trump. He's going to be served. We have a requirement that we're going to what we require of him as we the people and him being our president to correct the problems that these past administrations have created, which really is creating all of these federal agencies, militarizing them to begin with, and corrupting them and coming out to assault the people ultimately. This is what they've been doing across the nation. And they've been land grabbing in that process and silencing people who are going up against them and questioning them. Then they bring them in, they become political prisoners, and they prosecute them and throw them in jail for committing no crime at all, just exercising their unalienable right of free speech, the right to deny and reject and question. So anyway, but they have to be served in order to come. I presume this is what this person is talking about. They must be served in order for them to answer. and then there's a consequence if they don't answer. We've written it up as best we can, and there's a lot more to go on in here. We served both houses. We served the president, the Supreme Court, and I'm working on the papers right now to get the 50 governors also served. And really for them, it's an information, a notice of information, with the exception of Governor Cuomo here in New York, because we're going to go after him for making war against the Constitution and war against we the people with this gun issue we have going in New York. They're doing everything they can to control our guns, to make sure that they get them registered and eventually remove them. We know that that is their plan, and they'd love to do that in New York, of course. But so we're going to add him into this case also. We're in the process right now of putting together the paperwork for the Robinson case. We've had a meeting over the weekend with a few of the players out there out west who have information, have given us affidavits, and so we're going to enter that into the case also. And we'll start off with the habeas corpuses that they have failed to answer, the papers that the clerks failed to file, and the chief judges who failed to make sure that that the law was adhered to. And so we're going to go after those judges and those clerks, and they need to answer. We're going to do a show cause with them. And we're going to go after them for warring against the Constitution and we the people. So anyway, I don't know how else to add on to that that question, but that's about all I got.
Yeah, I think that's good. The next question is, in NLA papers, are U.S. Supreme Court cases the only court opinions that NLA uses in quotes and footnotes?
I'm sorry, say that again?
In the papers that we write at NLA,
uh-huh.
are U.S. Supreme Court cases and rulings the only court opinions that we use in quotes and in footnotes?
Oh, absolutely not. No, we use the Constitution constantly and, of course, the Bill of Rights, which is part of the Constitution. We use the Declaration of Independence. We use the Magna Carta. We use the Holy Bible. We use our Founding Fathers' words, and we use, the Federalist Papers. We use different essays. Goodness, I'm trying to think of that one guy that wrote the, what's the guy that wrote the essays on trial by jury? Lysander Spooner. Okay, so we bring in a lot of people. And when a Supreme Court makes a good ruling, like Marbury versus Madison, okay, is one, United States versus Williams, there's quite a few really good, powerful court cases out there where our Supreme Court justices stood for justice and held up the right position and made clear to the courts. And they ultimately rule over the federal district courts. As a matter of fact, that's why we're going after the federal United States Supreme Court at this point in time. We're not asking them to do anything, and we're not quizzing them directly in a show cause of any kind. We're telling them what they need to do. We're commanding them. We the people, we ordained and we established this Constitution for the United States of America. It's the law of the land. We wrote it. All law comes from the people, and they have to be obedient to that. And the Supreme Court has ruled that numerous times. They've agreed with that position, and now when a lower court is out of control, and all of the federal district courts are out of control at this point, they're in jurisdictions unknown. We're ordering the United States Supreme Court to do something about this. They need to correct this problem. And if not, then they too are warring against the Constitution. They too are subverting the process, and they too are guilty of also warring against we the people if they don't do the right thing. And the key thing to this whole thing is really exposing the truth, and that's why we need critical mass. As a matter of fact, everybody that's in this room tonight or hears this or later on, they download the MP3. Look, we all should be trying to get people to come to these meetings. We should all be trying to get people to come out to the National Liberty Alliance to understand what's really going on here and how we can take back this nation. And there's only one way, and that's to take back the judicial system. And we can do it. It's possible. As a matter of fact, some of the responses, not responses per se, but just the automatic response, the acknowledgement type thing and so on that we've gotten back from the courts just since we just filed, and the way they've responded back to us in certain ways tells us that, I think they got a lot more fear than we realize of us. And they should, because we are the people. But we have to hit that critical mass. We're very close. I do believe that we have enough people that are aware of our website that visit from time to time. And between that and our membership, that alone would be our critical mass. So we got to get the message out to the people who are, walking on that fence, walking on the line and just aren't making that next step over. And again, even if they don't become members, they should be coming to our meetings. They should be educating themselves. And they should be coming to the courts when that time comes. And that time is coming soon. We hopefully will flood the courts so greatly that they'll have to actually get a larger room, which they wouldn't even have in the courthouse. We have that possibility of doing that. And we do intend on making it clear on the courts that any hearings we do have and any trials we do go forward with in this court case will be videotaped and live streamed. This is the business of we the people. This is the problem that we are dealing with, is subversion against the United States of America from enemies, both foreign and domestic, at every level of government. And it's time we clean house. And most of these people that are subverting us are doing it because they have been extorted, because they have been bribed or under some kind of an extortion and the pressure, or they're just so stupid. But we need to wake them up, and we'll give them the olive branch, and we'll forgive them as long as they get behind us and stop working with us and take this nation back and give it to the people. And anybody who is against that, then they are our enemies, and we will do everything we can to make indictments and let trial juries decide their fate. They build enough prisons. We might as well use them for a good cause instead of the evil cause that these people have been using it for. All right. Anything else?
Just to clarify, the question was wondering whether the Supreme Court decisions are the only court decisions that we use in the U.S. court system for our courts.
I would only use the Supreme Court decisions. Yeah, I definitely would not use any lower court decisions at all, because they're not courts of record. And not that the Supreme Court is the court of record, but to some degree it is a court of record. And because their word is final, and we've given them authority in the Constitution. They are to rule over the lower courts. And so they are a court of record. And that's the key point to the court of record. You know, we've discussed this over the past couple of weeks, what a court of record is. And ultimately, it's a court that's run by a jury. In the case of the Supreme Court, it's a jury of nine. Ultimately, they're jurists, and they're making decisions on the cases that they have the authority to make decisions on. They clearly don't have the authority to make decisions on our cases. We, the people, when we make a decision, our decision is final. They cannot overturn it. They cannot change it. And any judge that overturns a case, for whatever the jury might have done, he's warring against the Constitution. He's warring against the people. He's warring against justice, because they don't have the power or the authority. We are the authority. We are the power. The people need to start acting the way they should be, as the owners of this country. They need to start acting with the power and the authority they've been given. But they also need to become educated in order to do that. Otherwise, we become just as dangerous as they are. You know, there's nothing worse than ignorance and action. So, they are a court of record. When they make a final decision concerning the federal district courts, you know, overturning a case here or there on the federal district courts now, not on courts of records, though. Again, let me say what a court of record is. A court of record, ultimately, the bottom line is a trial by jury. That's a court of record, okay? And it's eternal. It cannot be broken. And that is the difference. Now, of course, we the people can overturn the United States Supreme Court. We can nullify anything they have to say if we know that it's wrong, or just because we want to. Remember, we can nullify anything. We can even nullify a good law if we want to in a particular case when it becomes injurious in some way, or something is wrong that this shouldn't be applied for whatever reason. We can nullify anything, because we are the authority. We are the lawmakers. We the people. And it starts, of course, with the Constitution, that we made that law which governs our government. We've set forth the jurisdiction, what jurisdictions they have, what powers, what authorities, and we set forth restrictions. We set forth the Bill of Rights, which are things they cannot do. Don't do this, don't do that, and don't do the other thing. You know? We are the lawmakers. Now, of course, there's a higher law than us. We get to create the law that governs our government, ultimately. But God governs in the courts of justice when an injury takes place, and we have to apply the law of the heart. You know, God says he's written his law in our hearts. You know, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, and so on. Those are his laws, and we cannot negate them. We cannot deny them. For every injury, there must be a remedy. That's the law. For every injury, there must be a remedy. We cannot look the other way. We cannot ignore a case when someone's injured. So we can't nullify that law, but we surely can nullify any law that anybody tries to bring up. If the United States Supreme Court tries to legislate off the bench and make a declaration concerning a case that this is the correct answer to the problem or whatever it is, and we disagree, we just nullify it. We ignore it and don't use it. And we can cast it out. And we do that through the power of the jury. That's the power of the people. That's where we have our consent of government. The government needs to come begging us whether we can have a case or not against, if they want to take a case against somebody, they have to come beg the people. They have to come and ask the grand jury for permission. And we either accept it or we deny their petition. And it's that simple. And of course, we the people can bring any case up that we please and consider it for an indictment and then bring it before trial if the indictment comes in. But that's how we give consent to our government. We consent in our courtrooms, in the courthouse, in the trials, in indictments. But we also consent. There's the other side of that is the political process through the committee man, which they also have taken control of and destroyed that also. George Washington warned against that, and that's what happened. So we can take control there, too. We do intend on taking that control back and giving back to the people at the grassroots. But we can't do that until we take control of the courts. Matter of fact, National Liberty Alliance Beginnings was all about that. It was all about the committee men and the political process to save the nation through the political process by bringing it back to the people for the consent of the people. And we found it to be an uphill battle at every step of the way. And we discovered by bringing it into the courts that it was even a bigger uphill battle. And that every time you walked into a courtroom, you had to argue and fight a judge before you can deal with the case at hand. It's constantly the same thing. And the solutions and the answers they gave were always the same. The government always prevailed. It was status quo. Well, not anymore. There is no more status quo. Not in this case that we're bringing forward before the courts now. And we're bringing tremendous amounts of cases. Tremendous amounts of people are going to be brought before this trial, in this trial. And there's numerous trials that's going to take place. And we're going to overwhelm them. And again, this is up to the people. The question is, do you want to save America? Because only people can save America. I can't do it. No individual can do it. A lot of people are resting in Trump. Trump can only do so much. He can't do it. Ron Paul, when he was running for president, he tried to let everyone know also. He's only going to be able to do so much if he gets in, because it really is up to the people. And whatever good things are done, only the people can make sure that they're maintained and kept. So we have to get power. We have to take the power, the political power and the judicial power, and that's all the power we need. They break the law, we indict them. We keep them on a narrow path, and we bring out that stick and strike them with it when they step out of line. We let them know, you know, you continue down that path, we're going to indict you. So, again, do you want to save America? Well, it's up to the people to step up and do something. And it goes far beyond, first of all, people should be given $5 a month or more. There's very few people who do that, by the way. We barely make it by. And we're always in need of money, but there are so many people that do not give $5 a month or more. And some people can give 10 or 15 or 20, you know, but they don't do it. I guess they don't want to save America. And it's the same thing with stepping up and being, volunteering, becoming an administrator, coming to the meetings, becoming educated, taking the civics course. You know, we've got a lot of people who started the course, got partway through it, and then just fell away. Where are they? It's time to wake up. You know, this is it. This is it right now. This is it. There's a lot of stuff going on. You know, Trump is really causing commotions everywhere. Well, this is an opportunity for us to jump into that game and cause commotions from our perspective and bring it to them from the other direction. We need to put them on the run. We need to put the pressure on them. We need to drive them back into their rat holes. But only the people can do that. So I want to challenge everybody to bring somebody else to our next Monday night meeting. Get a friend, get a neighbor, get another person that's in the Liberty Group, and get them to this meeting. I also want to challenge people to get people who are already in our group that haven't been coming to the meetings to get them to the meetings. Look, we need that critical mass now. This is the moment we've worked for 5 or 6 years forward for, too. This is it. We're at that point. We need that critical mass. We're going to go forward, and we're going to hope that the critical mass is going to meet us. We're very close, but we expect that the critical mass is going to meet us. And if it doesn't, then you know what? The people spoke. They don't want America no more. They want this subversive group of crazy, insane people who are ruling this world, ruling all the governments of the world, United States included. That's what they want. They prefer that, then that's what they'll have. But I'll take it down to the wire, and those of us who want to save America, we'll take it to the wire. Anything else out there, Jan?
Yes, there is another question and then an announcement. The next question pertains to the document you just mentioned, the number 1005 judicial notice to magistrate. The question is, where will the common law grand jury administrators people to appoint as special prosecutors?
Where will what?
Where will the grand jury administrators find people that they can appoint as special prosecutors?
Oh, well, I know at least three or four people off the top of my head whose names I will not give. Who are very capable of doing that job. And so I got a couple people I know that I can approach and ask if they want to do that job. But I'm not the only one. There's other people that know people, I'm sure, that would be good candidates. And even the people that I would know that would ask, they would know people. We would find people capable of doing the prosecution here. I don't think that's a problem at all. So is that the question?
Yes.
Where we'll get them?
Yes.
That's it?
That's,
okay. Yeah, that's a simple task. And we're not going to let this judge stick his, we're not going to let this magistrate stick his judge's fingers into this case, because if he does, we're going to cut him off. We'll add him onto the list of people that we'll bring in as defendants. Right now, we're calling them respondents. Soon, we'll be calling them defendants when it's necessary. All right, anything else?
Yes, I have two announcements for tonight. Concerns the special meeting tomorrow night. It'll be in this Monday night room. You get in the same way as you did tonight. The first meeting will start at 8 Eastern time, and it concerns mortgage and foreclosure issues. We're trying to locate people that might be able to help out with the processing or suggest things that we might be doing, that sort of thing. And so if you know of someone that works in that area or might like to help, please get them to the meeting tomorrow at 8 o'clock. And then at 9 o'clock, some people have requested that we start a prayer group. And so at 9 o'clock, we will hold an exploratory meeting. That's tomorrow night, January 17th, and at 9 o'clock. And to get in, it's the standard, either come in through the weekly call, punch the green phone, or you can call the number 712-770-4160 and use access code 385-698-POUND. And that's all the announcements for tonight.
Okay, thanks, Jan. Yeah, 8 p.m., that foreclosure and mortgage thing, you know, we really want to kind of look at that. Hopefully we get a lot of people in there that want to get involved. But, you know, we get people involved and they want us to help with their cases, and that's okay. But we need their help to other things, or even to do those things that necessary for those cases. So we need people who are going to get involved, not just people who have problems. And those people who have problems should be the first ones up to get involved to begin with. But we need people involved. If you're not going to get involved, what are we going to do? What good are we if we're not going to get involved? You know, we have to take this nation back. The nation can't save itself. Constitution can't defend itself. That's what, that's the job of we the people. And if we the people don't understand that we need to do that, don't have the insight to see that we need to do that, or have no desire to find the time to do that, then we don't deserve liberty. We just don't deserve it. And we're not going to have it. Therefore, we will not have it, because we will not deserve it. So liberty is something we have to fight for, bring back, and maintain and hold. We have to put our time into it. We're not talking a lot about a lot of time. We're millions of people. You know, we only have to put, each one of us takes a little time here and a little time there. You know, we volunteer 2 years as a committee man. You sit on a jurist panel when you're called for, and you get involved and volunteer to help the administrations of the juries and any place else. Even with the committee men, volunteer, get educated, educate our children. You know, this is not a big thing. This is not really, you know, looking to ask for full-time effort. But if you're not given any effort in the repairing and taking back of your country, if you're not out there doing something, then you're doing nothing. And if everyone's doing nothing, we're going to lose it. At this point, I could tell you most people are doing nothing. So, look. Get involved. We've got a lot of committees here. You know, we're moving and pushing people to get the local groups going. You know, the committees of safety. The committees of safety is the most important thing at this point in time that anyone can do. This is what our founding fathers used to save the nation, to create a nation, to save their local governments, to save and to keep the peace, to defend themselves, and to build a nation. That was all done through the committees of safety. And we've laid it out exactly how our founding fathers did it. We've laid out these things, what's necessary to do in your local governments and how to get involved. And you can have a big voice, you know, all politics is local. If you control your local politics, if the local people control the local politics, you're totally protected against the big government. Because if the local government understands their authority and their jurisdiction and their duty to defend the Constitution and to defend the people and to make sure that the people are armed, not that they're going to arm them, but to allow them to be armed, okay, as the militia. New York Constitution says it is the duty of the people. It doesn't even clarify child, doesn't elderly, no age, male, female, doesn't say anything. It is the duty of the people to defend the state. That's what the New York State Constitution says. I wonder what other state constitutions say about that. People should look into that, and maybe on next Monday meeting or other Monday meetings come up, you know, let us know what your constitution says. Raise your hand and read it, that little section. We'd like to know. So it's the duty of the people to defend the state. And you can't defend the state if you're not armed. Just think about that. New York's Constitution says it's the duty of the people to defend the state. We have a governor trying to disarm us. Been trying to do so since he's been in office, and the governor before that. We got the state police working, and the superintendent of the state police has said in a public forum or through a press conference, when asked, would they take the guns away from the people? And the superintendent said, if the governor tells me to take the guns away from the people, we're taking the guns away from the people. To me, that's words of war. That's what that means to me. That's war. They're warring against the Constitution. They're warring against we the people. They want to disarm us. Why do they want to disarm us? Come on, we all know that. History is full of reasons why they want to disarm us. We wrote a paper on that exact purpose of why governments disarm people. Every single time governments disarm people, every single time they come out and they then attack the people. They kill the people. They assault them. Every single time. So, anyway, any other questions here? I guess I answered everything. No?
No, that was the last question.
All right, I think I'm going to quickly go through this paper. I'm not sure whether we did it. You don't think we read this paper, right?
I went back 4 weeks and looked at the transcript, and I didn't see it referenced by number or title.
Okay. Okay, let me read this. I may jump. It's kind of short anyway. It's only 6 pages. It looks like it may be double-spaced, and this should be pretty short. Let me read it, okay? This is the purpose for this was really to make the court to have judicial cognizance of the way this court case is going to go. But it's not just them. We also want all of the people, all of the defendants or the respondents to understand how this case is going to go forward. So they get a copy of this also. They get all the memorandums, they get a copy of that. We give that when we serve the action, we also put in all these memorandums. And we also have filed them into the court. But this is it. It goes up. This is against, of course, the United States Congress, the U.S. President, the U.S. Supreme Court, state governors, and John and Mary Doe, ETAL. And it's the grand jury, the sovereigns of the court. And this is a judicial notice. And it starts off, the court is to take judicial cognizance. We, the people, have been providentially provided legal recourse to address the criminal conduct of persons themselves entrusted to dispense justice. In the Supreme Court case of the United States versus Williams, Justice Anton Scalia, writing for the majority, confirmed that the American grand jury is neither part of the judicial, executive, nor legislative branches of government, but instead belongs to the people. It is, in effect, a fourth branch of government, governed and administered directly by and on behalf of the American people, and its authority emanates from the Bill of Rights. The court further said, thus, citizens have the unbridled right to impanel their own grand jury and present true bills of indictment to a court, which is then required to commence the criminal proceedings. Our founding fathers precedently, how do you pronounce that? Do you know that? Are you reading with me, Jan, on this?
No, I'm not.
Precedently. Anyway, thereby created a buffer the people may rely upon for justice when public officials, including judges, criminally violate the law. I want to reread the first part of the sentence. Thus, citizens have the unbridled right to impanel their own grand jury and present true bills of indictment to a court, which is then required to commence a criminal proceeding. You can't get any more clearer than that. And if you want proof, just go back to the very first grand jury that we are aware of, the first grand jury that we have a record of, and that's the Magna Carta. And we, the people back then, impaneled ourselves and took control and went forward with an indictment process and created, at that point, I believe that's when they created it. At least they put it on paper. Because the grand jury is an institution separate from the courts over whose functioning the courts do not preside, we think it clear that, to the general matter, at least, no supervisory judicial authority exists. So we're not to be supervised by the courts, by the judge. The judge is not to tell us how to look at the law, how to interpret law. If law needs to be interpreted, then it's no law at all. Let me repeat that. If law needs to be interpreted, it is no law at all. It's null and void. It always has to go. You have to give the benefit to the people every single time when there's an interpretation that you have two different sides to it. It's no law at all. It's bad law. And clearly common law does not need to be interpreted. It's crystal clear, cut and dry. Every man, every woman knows in the heart what common law is. And if you want to know what constitutional law is, just go read the Constitution. What powers have we given to the legislators? There are 18 powers we gave to the legislators. 18. Not 19, not 20, not 25, 18. We should know each one of them. And they do anything outside of those 18, then they broke the law. It's not part of the law. So any kind of legislation that they make outside of that authority is null and void. Okay, anyway, no judicial authority exists. It's rooted in long centuries of Anglo-American history. Hanna versus Losh. The grand jury is mentioned in the Bill of Rights. Well, he's actually quoting that case inside this case. This is still the United States versus Williams, by the way. The grand jury is mentioned in the Bill of Rights, but not in the body of the Constitution. It has not been textually assigned, therefore, to any of the branches described in the first three articles. It is a constitutional fixture in its own right. In fact, the whole theory of its function is that it belongs to no branch of the institutional government. It's serving as a kind of a buffer or referee between the government and the people. This is pretty clear and cut. There's no debate here. This is not a moot situation. This is not debatable. It's clear as day. Although the grand jury normally operates, of course, in the courthouse and under judicial auspices, its institutional relationship with the judicial branch has traditionally been, so to speak, at arm's length. It's not to be touched. Judges' direct involvement in the functioning of the grand jury has generally been confined to the constitutive one of calling the grand jurors together and administrating their oaths of office. That's it. There's nothing more for them to do. Go away now. We'll do our job. They can't be trusted to do that. Of course, they can call for a grand jury and we'll accommodate them, but we can call for a grand jury and we will accommodate them too. We, the people, need to take control of this administrative process because this has been the destructive measure. This is the destructive tool that they've used to destroy our consent of government. They've destroyed the freedom and the understanding of law of the people, by the people, through these juries. The grand jury requires no authorization from its constitutional court to initiate an investigation. Nor does the prosecutor require leave of court to seek a grand jury indictment. And in its day-to-day functioning, the grand jury generally operates without the interference of a presiding judge. And it swears in its own witnesses. It deliberates in total secrecy. The grand jury remains free to pursue its investigations, unhindered by external influences or supervision, so long as it does not trench upon the legitimate rights of any witnesses called before it. Recognizing this tradition of independence, we have said that the Fifth Amendment's constitutional guarantee presupposes an investigative body acting independently of either the prosecuting attorney or the judge. I want to read that one more time. Recognizing this tradition of independence, we have said that the Fifth Amendment's constitutional guarantee presupposes an investigative body acting independently of either the prosecuting attorney or the judge. The passage of the Unconstitutional Organic Act of 1871 and all latter construction upon it that judges have covertly used to seize control of our federal district courts in an effort to bypass the law of the land in order to ensure the abusive will of the state was an act of treason and thereby warring against the Constitution and we the people. Therefore, it is null and void. Cohen versus Virginia. We judges have no more right to decline the exercise of jurisdiction which is given than to usurp that which is not given. The one or the other would be treason to the Constitution. This is an extraordinary process. This is a case concerning subversion by enemies both foreign and domestic within our government, including our federal judiciary. We, the people, have reported these subversions over the past year in all 94 federal district courts through informations, and the federal judiciary has not acted upon them. We, the people, over the past year have served writs upon all servants within the federal government demanding obedience to the law of the land and have filed said writs in all 94 federal district courts, and the response has been a deafening silence as our elected servants continue in their lawlessness. Therefore, we the people proceed as follows. 1. This is a court of record under the people's own authority. See statement of jurisdiction. And will proceed according to the rules of common law. See the common law handbook. We wrote a common law handbook, and we have inserted this into the case, by the way. A copy will be found at National Liberty Alliance dockets. Two, federal rules will be adhered to in as much as they are not repugnant to the law of the land. So we're going to notify the United States attorney here in the Northern District and give him a copy of all the papers and so he can read them and for his own enjoyment and education. But we're going to also file a paper also on him to let him know he's not to interfere. He's not to represent. No, none of these people ought to have representatives. None of them. They can talk to people and get some ideas and counsel if they want, but no counsel is going to talk for them in court. They have to speak for themselves. Why? Because they have a duty to speak. Why? Because they're an elected individual with authority and power and jurisdictions in different areas, and they are violating those things, and they have to answer to the questions that we have concerning that. And so they must answer, and if they don't answer, it's fraud. If they answer through a lawyer, it's fraud. As far as we're concerned, they're criminals. They're warring against the Constitution. Three, the common law grand jury is normally comprised of 25 people. Due to the nature of this case, there are approximately 6,000 jurists representing all 50 states that make up this grand jury. When called into session, a quorum will be made up of 100 people. It could be as many people who show up will participate. If 1,000 people show up, then 1,000 people will participate. But a quorum will be 100. And that's for any indictments we do through this case. And the reason why we raised it so high on this is because we're in every state of the union, and we want people from every state of the union to be part of this, and we want to give that opportunity. We have 50 states. So the grand jury will appoint four administrators here and after the sureties of the peace who will administrate and advise the jurors when called upon by the jury foreman of the trial juries. Four, the trial juries will be made up of 12 people chosen from a pool that the federal district court already adheres to. We'll use their pool of people. Unless we find that that's biased somehow, that they have, X'd out a certain group of people, we're going to make sure that we get a good pool of people that represents the people. The grand jury will provide an appropriate questionnaire. And we wrote a paper on this questionnaire problem, and that's how they stack the juries. When cases become ripe for trial, the sureties of peace will call upon the magistrate to muster a jury, and the jury will be orientated by the sureties of the peace. Judges are magistrates in courts of record and entrusted with the administration of the law, whereas the people will decide both facts and law through an untainted jury chosen according to the common law. Be advised that the federal grand jury and jury handbooks are repugnant to the common law, and thereby null and void. See memorandum jury tampering and stacking, found at NLA, and of course we give them a copy. Magistrates are to make no rulings without leave of the sovereigns of the court. So before a judge wants to make some kind of a decision, or we may order the judge to make a certain signature on a page in order to execute the law, whatever the case may be, okay, well, it's got to go through the sovereigns of the court. And the sovereigns of the court in this case is the administration of the grand jury, the four individuals. When elected servants are called upon to answer the people's demands for a redress of grievance, this is number six. When elected servants are called upon to answer the people's demand for a redress of grievance, they are to answer in a sworn affidavit directly and not through an attorney. Any unsworn answer through an attorney will be considered a non-answer. Elected and appointed servants have a duty to speak. Silence will be equated with fraud and will be brought before the grand jury for consideration for indictment. After indictment, the prosecutor will give the defendant a copy of the indictment at the arraignment and the voluntary disclosure form, which includes information about the case, such as the date, time, and place of the crime and of the arrest. The defendant will be informed about the substance of his statements and of his identification. The defendant will then enter a plea of guilty or not guilty to the indictment. Bail may be reviewed, and different conditions may be set. 7. the sureties of the peace will appoint a special prosecutor. 8. Once indicted, servants will be removed from office and have a right to counsel. If they cannot afford a legal counsel, they can petition the court, and if they qualify, the court will provide counsel. 9. It is the duty of all magistrates to exercise the power vested in them for the good of the people according to the law, and with zeal and fidelity. A neglect on the part of a magistrate to exercise the functions of his office when required by law is a misdemeanor. And that was dated January 5th, 2017, sealed and signed by the jury foreman. Okay, so anyway, that's the paper. I guess we didn't read it before. It lays out the way this court case is going to go. We, the people, are going to take control of this court case the way it should be. Our elected servants do not have any part or of any way, shape, or form of trying to convict as far as being a jurist or making a decision or a ruling. They don't have the authority to do that over we, the people. They never had the authority. Why did we let them do that? Are we insane? We allow judges to make a decision and maybe give us a fine or put us in jail for 3 months or 3 years? What, are we crazy? Letting a political animal to make those decisions? Constitution does not permit that. Common law does not permit that. We the people should not permit that. And we, in this case, we the people will not permit that either. And we will take and fight tooth and nail on this case, on this. And that's just one paper. We are overwhelming the court. If you go out to the nationallibertyalliance.org and go down to grand jury, I like grand jury, click on dockets, okay? And look at all the papers we've already filed. We've filed 17 papers already. As far as papers that are being filed as memorandums or papers of actions, okay, we've got about 17 documents of evidence already. We've got numerous law documents, information, and writs. All of this is part of the evidence process and also the law that we're using to bring into the courts by what authority we act upon. And we also we brought in here the habeas corpus and different proceedings that we were involved with in the Robinson case, where these people have thumbed their nose at the people, thumbed their nose at justice, thumbed their nose at God himself. And they think that they're going to get away and do what they want to do. We're going to bring them into our court, and they're going to answer. We're going to give them show causes. And they need to answer this. They need to let this man out of prison. He certainly doesn't belong there. He's a political prisoner. And we're going to make that case in the fact that he's a political prisoner, as well as the case in Oregon and the assassination of Lavoy Finnegan and the case against the Bundys out there in Nevada and many, many other cases. We have some 30 or so habeas corpuses that have been ignored by the courts. Well, we want to know why. And by what authority, and who do they think they are, then that these people who are servants of the people, we put them in office, they're our servants, who do they think they are to deny us of due process? You know, the purpose of a habeas corpus is to exercise and force the courts to give us due process. We already have it in our Bill of Rights, due process. Due process is an unalienable right, whether it's written in the Bill of Rights or not, but it's there. We have a right of due process. These people have never been given due process, ever. They make it look like they've been given due process. They make it look like they've been given a grand jury and indictment. They make it look like they've had a trial by jury and got an indictment or whatever the case may be. It looks that way, but it's all a lie. It's jury stacking. It's jury tampering. It's cover-up. They deny the Constitution, and they don't even hide it anymore. They deny, right in court, they just deny it. You can't talk. You can't read the Constitution here. You can't read the Bible here. Who are these people? Why do we let them get away with this? I hope people are angry enough now to get up and become part of this critical mass. We need this critical mass, and we need it now. We can't wait no more. We're going full speed ahead. We need the critical mass behind us. All right. Anyway, that's that with that paper. Is there anything else? Any other announcements or anybody that has anything to say out there, Jen? Any leaders, yes, or anything to bring something up?
Yes, there is one more thing. Robert has another short update from the Western Patriots.
Okay.
If this is a good time.
Yeah, this is a good time.
Okay, Robert.
Howdy.
Greetings.
Am I coming through okay?
Yep, great.
But anyway, it's just a short thing. There's been a lot of prayer rallies leading up to this next court case here in Portland. Of course, the weather has been below freezing so much here lately that there's not a lot going on. However, just a reminder that not only is the inauguration on Friday, but the next hearing here in Portland is also Friday. And for those that are in the area, we'd like to see you all there.
Have we been
sure
getting calls out for that, Robert? Have we been making calls to get whatever people we can out there from our NLA here? Do you know? We need to get some calls going out on this. Anybody that's out in that area should try to get out there and give this guy support, give these people support.
Yeah, the hearings normally start like 9 a.m., but not everybody is going to get in the courtroom because they're so small. However, there'll be all of us outside the courthouse as well as those inside the courthouse, and the more people, the merrier. They notice us, they see us, they're concerned about us. And so the more people, the better. And an interesting note on the Nevada case is another judge has stepped up, and they're going to have a special hearing on the 24th for Ryan Bundy to talk about turning him loose. I don't know what brought it up, but I certainly hope that it happens. It was a big surprise to a lot of us. I don't know whether it's just on bail, and I suppose it is just bail
It's only one reason why that's happening. Only one reason. Look at what they have done. They've murdered a man. Okay, they assassinated an individual. They have put these people in prison. They have denied them everything. They've denied them even just a place to sleep comfortably, or basically sleep, to have a right to sleep, and a right to eat, and a right to medicine. And these people never should have been put in jail at all, ever. The worst case, it's a fine if they wanted to do that, and I'd fight that also. But nevertheless, okay. Why are they letting them loose? Why, well, if they let them loose, we got to ask the question why. There's only one reason why. Only one reason why. And this should give us a lot of really an opportunity to really jump onto something here. The only reason they're doing it is because they're frightened. That could be the only reason why.
Why is it just him? Why isn't it all of them?
Well, I think this is where it begins. Okay, I don't know, and let's see what happens. And if it is a release, I'm sure a lot more is going to be released. And on top of that, I think you're going to start to see a breakdown here. Look, Trump is moving in. He's already made some statements. He's got some anticipation. He's already been watching what's going on there. He's read our papers. He's read their papers. He sees what we're doing. So there's a movement from that end, and they better be worried about that. And we're pushing Trump.
Yeah,
if anybody's read the paper we wrote for the president here, we're pushing him to require the law to be obeyed. Remember, the president appointed these judges. The president appointed these marshals. The president appointed the clerks. All these people. So he's got the ability to get rid of them. Go ahead, Robert.
I do have more information, but I'm not at liberty to talk about it right now. I will say that I'm ready to make a prediction that by the end of this month, all our patriots are going to be freed.
I think that's a very good prediction, and I agree there's a good possibility, because we hear the echoings, so to speak. We hear the grapevine. You know, we hear what's going on. They're frightened, and they better be frightened. And we're coming out stronger than ever. With these papers we're filing now, we've been filing for a while, so it's not that, like, they don't know us. And we're very serious about what we're doing, and they know that. They got to be frightened. And so they got to start making some moves to try to protect themselves, and I think that's what they're doing. And again, this is the opportunity for the people to pile on. We need the people's involvement. Let's go, people, everybody. Let's get involved. Let's take this country back.
Well, we all know about the medical maltreatment in the prisons. We had a man in Nevada die the other day.
Yeah, we
not
heard.
One of ours, but one of the other inmates.
Well, that's the other thing, by the way. Even if they let him loose or let them loose, we're going after all these people. We want to know by what authority they acted. And we also want to get a trial going with the murder of Lavoy Finnegan. We're going to get that trial going here in New York because they don't want to do it out there. And again, this is part of subversion. It's got to take place somewhere. It's going to happen in New York. And we never thought, we thought it would be New York, but then we thought, well, maybe it's going to be out west, you know. But now it ends up back to New York. We're going to do it here. It's going to happen.
Better. And also, one other thing is, you know, the Patriots, Lavoy Finnegan and them, they never did make it over to Grant County to have their meeting. Well, it's going to happen on the 27th, I think. It's going to happen this year. Mrs. Finnegan is going to hold that meeting.
Hey, Robert.
So yes.
Did they ever say what charges they were going to put on the guys in Oregon? Remember, the other guys got acquitted, and then they said they were going to consider new charges. Did they announce that yet or no?
No, that'll be on Friday when that comes out. They're supposed to have their answers on Friday as to what charges are going to be. In fact, it affects both the attorney Mumford and the misdemeanor charges on the other Patriots.
Yeah, they're skating on thin ice here, and that's why it's important for a lot of people to come out, because they won't want to do stupid stuff when people are watching.
Right.
And I'm also wondering if they're not starting to worry about the health of the prisoners, and maybe that's why they're letting Ryan go. Maybe there's something going on, and, you know, God forbid something happens to him, they know.
Well, it was kind of a surprise announcement on that. Nobody knew that anything had been done to lead up to it or anything. It just happened.
Yeah, that's interesting, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, maybe it's time to remove that bullet from his shoulder.
Yeah, the one he won't give. Yeah, exactly.
That's right. Get him out of there and get it out and keep the bullet.
Yep.
Well, look, they haven't even addressed the murder, and that's a big, big problem here. Big problem.
Well,
all right, anything else, Robert?
No, I just find that this hearing on the 20th could be very interesting as to what charges they're actually going to put on Mumford and the misdemeanor charges on the Patriots. That could be very interesting. I think the courthouse will be jammed. The courtroom itself, and I'm hoping for a bunch of people outside.
All right, well, give us a report on the 23rd. The 20th is Friday, and the following Monday is the 23rd. So give us an update to get us as much information as you can. And any affidavits you can accumulate on any of these cases while you're, you know, working
Absolutely.
With these people, gather them together. So, okay?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, I'll be down there on Friday, and we'll see what happens.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
All right, let's move along. Anything else, Jan, or we're going to move on?
No, I think it's time to move on.
Okay. All right, we're going to move over to Brent. I see Brent is here. You're muted, so you want to unmute yourself, Brent. Brent is the author of The Excellence in the Common Law, and his website is commonlawyer.com. And Brent's going to talk to us about some subject matter of the Constitution here for the next 20 minutes or so, and then we'll do a Q&A. Brent?
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. Always appreciate you folk allowing me to come on and say a few things. The only remedy to the lawlessness we see is law, true law. The remedy is not Donald Trump or any other mere mortal people might be interested in thinking is going to make a difference. Men can make a difference, but only can they do so as they pay attention to and safeguard and do true law. We've been talking for now several months, a little bit each time, about the four militia clauses of our United States Constitution. Four militia clauses. Each of those militia clauses delineating the responsibilities, the duties of a particular group of people, a particular group of Americans. And we come now toward the end of what I've got to say about the militia, and at least for now. I don't know that we'll finish this time, but we're getting there. And we get to the end. We'll talk here about a model state militia statute. And I've included a model state militia statute. I call it the pattern of the state militia statute. At the end of the book by yours truly, a primer for the militia clauses of our U.S. Constitution, called the Militia of the Several States, our Constitution's answer to its enemies. So pursuant, and I put this together over a long period of time, got my head into it, and I just offer it as a pattern. So don't be too hard on me as I go through this. I have tried to contemplate doing it in such a way that it would be lawful and work well. This is pursuant to pattern state militia statute pursuant to the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 16B. In other words, this state militia statute concerns the responsibilities of the state legislature of your state. They should pass a statute, something like this, a state militia statute. So I'll begin with the preamble. By this state militia statute, the legislature means to protect the rights of the people of this state by enabling the responsibilities of that our United States Constitution delegates, respecting the militia of the several states among four classes of Americans: congressmen, state legislators, presidents, and the people. These four classes of people are, vis-a-vis each one of them, a particular militia clause, one of the four militia clauses of our United States Constitution: congressmen, state legislators, presidents, and the people. And as I read through this further, it ought to serve as a good review of all of the things that we've said about the militia of the several states over the past several months. Here goes. Whereas the purpose of the militia of the several states is to secure freedom and security at the same time by, first, stopping wrongful taking of life, liberty, and property; second, protecting our common law governmental laws against any government of mere men, whether foreign or domestic; and third, thereby thwarting overthrow of lawful government. That's the purpose of the militia of the several states. It's prevent the overthrow of lawful government. I think we came pretty close. If not close, it's actually happened. Forces of evil have gotten their bony fingers on the levers of power in America. Sex perverts that want nothing more than to blackmail every official in the United States. I'm not exaggerating the case. It's an international ring. And I've seen it in action even here locally. Next, whereas the people of this state recognize and declare the exclusive necessity of our militia to the security of our state and freedom, according to U.S. Constitution Amendment 2. Whereas the people of this state recognize and declare that our United States Constitution is an affirmation of our state common law militia. Whereas the people of this state recognize and declare that the Congress and presidents must draw their authority only from our U.S. Constitution. That said Constitution and each of the several states hold their authority direct from the people of the several states, and that the militia of each state comprise the people of that state. Whereas the people of this state could be your state, any state. This is a pattern state militia statute. Whereas the people of this state recognize and declare that our U.S. Constitution arranges duties under its four militia clauses among four classes of men: congressmen, state legislators, U.S. presidents, and individual Americans. Whereas the people of this state recognize and declare that we, the people of the several states of our Union, by our Constitution, have delegated to the President certain, yet limited, responsibilities respecting the militia of the several states. Whereas our United States Constitution recognizes concurrent jurisdiction of the militia of the several states, this state's governor having jurisdiction of this state's militia, while the President of the United States also has jurisdiction, under the restraints and according to the standards and rules our U.S. Constitution and Congress has set for him. Whereas this concurrent jurisdiction of the militia of the several states arises from an incontestable dual sovereignty of each of the several states along with and at the same time of the United States. Citing Prince versus United States from 1997 says that. It acknowledges it. Whereas our Constitution charges Congress alone with providing rules for calling forth the militia. Whereas our U.S. Constitution limits the reasons a president can call forth the militia of the several states or any part of these into the service of the United States to only three. Three reasons: to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. These three reasons and no others. These three reasons and more, by the way, in case anybody is interested. That's Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 15 and 16, gives the reason why the President of the United States can call forth the militia. And remember, our Constitution pertains to the duties of the President. It does not define the duties of governors of states respecting the militia. Doesn't define them very much at all, except to say they have a duty. Whereas our U.S. Constitution gives the President authority over any member of this state's militia only when called into actual service of the United States. That's Article 1, Section 8, again, Clauses 15 and 16. Whereas our Constitution reserves to each state, I'm quoting the Constitution, reserves to each state the appointment of officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. Congress only has the authority to prescribe the discipline of the militia of the several states. Congress does not have the power to make that happen. That's a division of powers between the states and the federal government. The states have the power to make it happen. Only Congress has the power to set it forth in writing by legislation. Whereas each state, accordingly, has the common law responsibility to provide practical standards for its militia, such as the kind of firearm and amount of ammunition each militiaman must himself provide to himself, keep, and bear, the training, discipline, and skill with this firearm, to which he must attain at his own cost, and any penalties for failure to do so. Whereas our Constitution bars infringement of each and every individual's God-given right to keep and bear arms. Now, somebody may say, now, where do you get the God-given right to keep and bear arms? Show me in the Bible where it says that. Well, that's like saying, show me in the Bible where it says you can't smoke tobacco. It doesn't say that. Tobacco wasn't part of their understanding. But the Bible does say that your body is the temple of God's gumption, the Holy Spirit himself. And because of that, you're not to defile your body unnecessarily. And so I would say that even though it doesn't mention the word tobacco, it seems to me that the first principle is applicable there. And if you don't want to defile your body with all the chemicals, especially cigarettes, well, that might be a good idea. Same thing with the right to keep and bear arms. The Bible says that a man has a duty to provide for his family. If he doesn't, he's worse than an unbeliever. Well, how can you provide for your family if you let other people kill and maim you? Therefore, you have a right to self-defense by a simple one-step inference. The Bible gives that right, and then nature. God teaches us in the nature of things, in the nature of the physical world around us, in the natural affection we have for our own families, that we should have the wherewithal to protect them, our wives and our children, our grandchildren, even our neighbors, our communities. And in this day and age, the evil empire bears guns, bears firearms. Our common law has always said that it is lawful to meet force with force. That doesn't mean you meet force with more force if it's not necessary. Our common law doesn't always say that's right. But our common law does say that a man has a right, that's a God-given duty, to meet force with force, to protect himself so that he can fulfill his functions. Besides, a dead man can't obey God at all, and neither can a dead man's family, or a man's family that's dead or hurt or impaired in some other way. The right to keep and bear arms, therefore, I conclude, again, by simple application to my own times and facts and circumstances, is a God-given, God-delegated duty called a right. Whereas our Constitution reserves to each state the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress, whereas each state accordingly has the common law responsibility to provide practical standards for its militia. Oh, I did that one already. Let me back up here. Repeating myself, maybe somebody needed to hear that twice. Maybe I did. Whereas our U.S. Constitution bars infringement, oh, that's the one I left out on. Next, whereas there is no other kind of fundamental right but individual. There is no such thing in God's created order of organizational rights. The only rights that our courts will ever recognize are the rights of individuals, and if they recognize some other kind of right, they're wrong. They've made a mistake at law. Rights are individual because God drops duties on the individual and the individual. And the individual alone will answer to God for the fulfillment of duties according to God's will. The individual, organizations will not answer. An organization is a fiction. It doesn't exist as a person. All rights are individual rights, and all of the fundamental rights our Constitution has recognized so far have been individual rights, and rightly so. Rightly so. Whereas our U.S. Constitution's Amendment 2 states that security and freedom at the same time are possible only as each militiaman of each state fulfills his duty in accord with our U.S. Constitution's four militia clauses. The Second Amendment is the fourth militia clause of our Constitution pertaining to the militia, recognizing the militia, protecting and ensuring and guaranteeing the duty, the right of the militiaman to keep and carry a gun, loaded. I could quote John Wayne here, I suppose. A gun that ain't loaded ain't good for nothing. What's the use of a right to carry a gun if it's not loaded? Whereas, accordingly, in order for our state to have the security of a free state, Amendment 2 bars the national government or any state government from interfering, that means infringing, with any one of the people's non-delegable right and duty to keep and bear arms. Whereas Congress has neglected our U.S. Constitution's mandate to provide rules for training the militia of the several states. Indeed, they have for about 175 years now. Congress has neglected its duty under that militia clause that tells it what its duty is, whereas the militia of our several states and the offices it fills are unique from any standing army or police forces. Accordingly, each of our U.S. Constitution's assignment of responsibilities respecting the militia of the several states are non-delegable and unassignable to any regular or reserve army, navy, or national guard, or to any police force or other bureaucracy or government agent. This is what we've seen has happened and has eroded this whole idea of our common law militia. Other concepts have taken over. National Guard units, Army units, active duty units, police agencies. Oh, the government's got enough guns now to take care of everything. Nobody needs to worry about it. Just kick back and relax. We'll take care of you. We'll protect you. Ask them in Chicago if they're protecting them. Whereas our U.S. Constitution's recognition and affirmation of the militia of the several states is the supreme law of the land. The supreme law of the land. What does that mean? That means the overarching way, W-A-Y, things are to be done. The law of the land is a common law phrase lifted from Magna Carta, and it means, without question, it was their phrase meaning due process. Not what is to be done as much as how it is to be done. And our common law is not a law of what is to be done. It's not the law of do's and don'ts. It's a law of process. It is the process. You know, when folks really begin to contemplate this in America, from the viewpoint of the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, they concluded really quick, our first fathers, sometimes called the Puritans, they didn't have any legislation, didn't want any. They said, we've got the substance of the law. We've got right and wrong dropped on us from outer space, out there where God lives. He's given it to us. Up in the skies, he invaded things here on land and told us, after he made us, he told us how to handle things. Therefore, we don't need the substance of the law, the do's and the don'ts. We need the how-tos. How can we make this really work? How do you do it? By the course of the common law, by the process. Justice James Wilson appointed to the Supreme Court when it was first established, along with John Jay. He said, our common law, it is a process, by the way. It is a course, a way of living. Our common law, he said, is of origin divine. Origin divine, fancy way of saying God gave it to us, the creator of all things, the judge of all the world, the great lawgiver, the only lawgiver. So the militia clauses of our Constitution are the law of the land. They are the way things are supposed to be done. And by the way, those four militia clauses define how this is to happen. The responsibilities that our Constitution delegates to four classes of people. See, I get to talking wrong. I get to talking unconstitutionally. The responsibilities that our Constitution delegates to three classes of people, the three militia clauses, the first three, and then last militia clause, the Second Amendment, delegates no responsibilities, but rather recognizes and guarantees protection of a duty, a responsibility, a right that God has given to the people to defend themselves. Big difference, an important distinction. We ignore it at the peril of our freedoms. The distinction between things that are recognized, rights that are recognized, duties that are protected in their exercise, and rights and duties that our Constitution of the United States delegates. Whereas our U.S. Constitution requires each state to organize, discipline, and train its own militia. Whereas both Congress and the several states have neglected and violated the mandates of the people by our U.S. Constitution's four militia clauses. Whereas our U.S. Constitution now depends upon no other class of persons to protect the rights and freedoms of the people of this state, except the militia of the several states. Don't miss this one. Watch me close. Our U.S. Constitution now depends upon no other class of persons to protect the rights and freedoms of the people of this state, except the militia of the several states. That's fact, friends, neighbors, and kin. There is nobody else. It's the people, period. And our Constitution, the whole tenor of it, woven in the warp and the woof coming at it from both directions. You put it all together, and that's what jumps out at you. It begins with the people, we the people of the United States. And then, with the militia clauses, the foundation of it is the rights that God has dropped on those people to defend themselves. The left, I don't like to call them the liberals. There's nothing liberal about them except they're just flat lawless. That's not liberality. That's not freedom. The left is buying guns and ammunition at a rate that they have never done so before. What if they get out of hand? The right has been extremely responsible with firearms throughout our history. The left? I don't know. I just know it's important that the people have the right to arm themselves and that, well, they do have the right. It's important. God gave it to them. It's important that the government protect it. And really the only governing body that can protect that right, and our Constitution makes it clear, is the people themselves, and they are the governing body. Whereas this state must never neglect its Constitution-required duty under our Second Amendment to never infringe upon the common law right of the people to keep and to bear arms, but to always encourage the people to keep themselves armed and skilled in the use of arms. You may remember Granville Sharp. I'd quoted him a while back. Granville Sharp was quite a character, and he was an avid student of the Bible, and especially an intense student of the Greek New Testament. Then he formulated a couple of observations, rules of the Greek tongue, the way it's used in the original manuscripts, of the Newer Testament. But he also did an extensive study on the common law right to keep and bear arms, along with the common law furred, the militia. And he concluded this, studying the history of our common law. He said, it has always, speaking of England, because he was an Englishman, he said it has always been the law of England that every man, able-bodied man, must arm himself and stay armed. And not only that, but our common law requires every man to be expert at arms. Expert. Finally, whereas unless the people of this state fulfill and enforce our U.S. Constitution's four militia clauses, the federal government will gain an unconstitutional monopoly of force and power and will oppress both the states and the people, as is now seen. After all those wherefores, then we hit, or whereases, I guess, then we hit therefore. Therefore, in recognition of the foregoing, the people of this state hereby enact this State Militia Act. I had a lot of whereases there, and the reason I had a lot of whereases there is because we have forgotten what our militia is all about. So I wanted to state categorically the law of our militia of the several states without any argument, as some would say, putting it in the form of dogmas, just stating it without supporting it. But it needs to be done, and that's why there were so many there. And this is the Militia Act. I've got about 3 more minutes I want to give this, and we'll be done. First, this pattern, State Militia Act, defines who are the members of the militia. Who are the members of the militia of the state? Could be your state, could be my state. The militia of this state includes, I'm reading the pattern State Militia Act at the end of my book, the militia of this state includes all males between the ages of 20 and 45. Now, some people would say, should be 16 and 45. Somebody else may say, 17 and 45. Well, I've got reasons for 20, and I think that that is an age of an accountability. The Bible makes clear, and men that are that old are accountable for their actions in ways others aren't, according to what God says. And any other standard that someone would throw in there would be purely arbitrary. I think it should be 16. I think it should be 21. I think it should be, even in the colonies, sometimes it was 16 before our country began. I think God's given us the answer. I won't dwell on that long. If anyone's interested, I can expound why I believe that, why I'm so sure in my mind about it. But he's given us a clear standard, and anything else is just an arbitrary guess. All males between the ages of 20 and 45 dwelling within this state's boundaries, having intent to dwell within this state for the indefinite future, and able-bodied to carry and fire the weapon this state's legislature designates, the militia of this state does not include females. So in this pattern state militia statute, all able-bodied males, able-bodied to carry and fire the weapon the state legislature designates. That's pretty much the militia common law. Number two, militia duty in this state shall remain voluntary, not mandatory, unless and until such time as this state's legislature acts to make militia duty mandatory for all able-bodied militia members. Now, this is a soft sell. I thought I maybe ought to put it this way, because the truth of the matter is, according to our Constitution, according to our common law, our Constitution is informed by our common law. It's pretty dogmatic also. When I say dogmatic, I mean it states what it wants to state, and it doesn't define or support anything. And it doesn't. It's a brief, a very brief brief. Even a legal brief has legal support. Our Constitution has none. And our Supreme Court has said the reason for that is it was not meant to define everything. And it was written to a people and for a people that were awash in that way of life called our common law. I think the Supreme Court justice uses the words imbibed. The people of our colonies, our first fathers, our forebears, lived in an atmosphere where they imbibed the common law. It was part of their breathing. Trial by jury was just the way it was. Nobody gave it a thought until England tried to take it away. Parliament said you can't do that anymore. By the way, that common law thing about keeping and bearing arms, the common law doesn't apply in our American colonies. You're under imperial law here because this is the empire. The king of England is king in England, but here he's emperor. And that was true. That's what they said. And it's been true throughout the history of the English Empire. The only difference was they made a miscalculation because the people in the American colonies were British, just like them. They were cousins. And in our Declaration of 76, that's appeal to ties, T-I-E-S, ties of consanguinity, con. That means with. Sanguine, Latin word means blood. We're tied together with the same blood, consanguinity. You can't do this to us. You can do that to the people on the other side of the world that may not know any better over in India and Pakistan, wherever else you, the Caribbean. But here, we migrated, our grandparents migrated from there, and we're related, and we know the difference, and you've let us stay. I was making a point today. I'll end with this, and we'll stop discussing the militia statute. King George III was the son of King George II. King George II was the son of King George I. King George I and King George II were Germans born in Germany. King George III was a German born in Britain. But he was German nonetheless, but he was born in Britain. King George I and King George II liked British beer, or British German beer, and German frows better than they did being King England. And they spent a lot of time in Germany drinking beer and visiting their lady friends. And that was for several decades that went on. They didn't pay any attention at all into ruling England, but they always showed up on payday. Well, because of that, the government was rather ineffective, and the freedom of the American colonies was without limit. And the prosperity of the American colonies was so great, had grown to such a pitch, that when George III got into office, Parliament thought they had somebody they could control. He was such a nice guy, had 10 children, he loved to make garden, just a nice fella. They thought they could control him, and they began to threaten him. And they said, all that wealth over there in America, we've got to get a handle on that. And so that's what happened. They tried to get a handle on something they'd let get out of hand, namely freedom. Freedom. Just leave people alone. We don't care if you get into office and spend all your time playing. Just don't pass any more legislation. We're tired of it. And by the way, it will hamper us, and we can't really be a prosperous people. Isn't that amazing? That's what happened in America, and that's why we went to war. One of the other reasons, they said the common law doesn't apply. We're going to start regulating you. You're under admiralty law. The British East India Company is now in charge, and you've got to deal with our bank, our currency. We've got a monopoly on that, and you can only buy goods from the British East India Company, which was an arm of the Bank of London. And the war was on. So the militia became very important to them, and that's why those clauses are part of our Constitution. They recognized that a standing army is dangerous. They had experiences with it. They saw what would happen. They saw the Hessians. The reason the Hessians were here is because King George was a German prince. He controlled that section of Germany. And if he wanted them to come over and give their lives, that's what they had to do. And they did. They wanted none of it. And the only protection we have in America for ourselves and our freedoms, the only protection, is the militia of the several states. That's all I've got this evening, John. Thanks.
Thank you, Bern. Appreciate that. Okay, if anybody has any questions or comments, the Q&A is open, star 6 to get into the queue. If you have any questions for Brent or just general questions, get into the queue and ask them. Again, star 6 to get into the queue. Nobody in the queue yet, as a matter of fact. Usually people start piling in pretty quickly.
Yep. It's star 6 and then a 1. You have to hit the 1 after star 6 to get into the queue.
I think it tells you that, doesn't it, when you get in there, they start...
I don't know. I've never gone in the queue.
Okay. All right. We have Eric, a VoIP dialer. Eric, maybe you can tell us what state you're from. Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, this is Eric in Georgia. I was going to wait because I get on fairly often, but no one was getting in, so I figured I'd jump in. So, yeah, Eric here in Georgia. Let's see. I guess I have a few questions. I'll just keep it to one. Let's see here. Brent mentioned, we're supposed to be fruitful, multiply, spread across the land. But he mentions a smallpox and the attempted genocide. They were going to inoculate the slaves, but the king and parliament, I guess the crown, was going to poison us. And I've only ever heard of the smallpox as far as, say, conquistadors or, you know, what we did to the Indians. And I was wondering if Brent might discuss a bit more about where he heard this and where I might be able to find it, about how the crown was going to do this to us, the colonies. Thank you.
Well, I got that information. I got that information out of a book written by a Revolutionary War soldier from Connecticut, signed up at age 16, served 7 years, was at the battle. He laid out 1 year during the war, and then he re-enlisted. He participated in the Battle of Yorktown. His name was J.P. Martin. J.P. Martin. And the name of the book is J.P. Martin, The Memoirs of a Revolutionary Soldier, written in his old age after he was old and he had some crippling problems at that time, I think. But he tells of all of his boyish experiences. He began awful young. He was in his 20s when it was over, 23, I believe. But he tells of General Washington taking them all of the boys in the army, and telling them he wanted them to be vaccinated for smallpox. And they knew at that time that everybody knew if you got a smallpox vaccination, you 10% chance you'd be dead, if not more, because no one knew how to ration it out in the right amounts. And that's what happened, for example, to the man that people yet today call the greatest mind America ever produced, Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards, second president of Princeton College, Princeton Bible College, what now Princeton University. He volunteered to receive the vaccination because he thought it was important, because it had been killing so many people. You know, George Washington's face was scarred terribly as a man because of his bout with smallpox when he was young. It was something that was devastating people. If it didn't kill you, it'd bar you awful bad. And Jonathan Edwards died. But General Washington wanted the troops to be vaccinated, and they submitted to the vaccination. But because they couldn't ration it out at the right amounts, they all knew also that at the least, if they did die, that their bodies would be scabbed up, and they each man would be out of commission for about 2 weeks. And so the Army submitted to it, the Continental Army. They didn't have to, but they did. That tells something about their commitment. And they did it in staggered sections so that there would always be a large section of the Army that was able to fight, and the ones that were vaccinated for 2 weeks had to lay out while their bodies were scabbed up. They'd try to be near water. They'd put them in barns near a river someplace, and the boys would go in the river and rub each other's backs and shoulders and bodies with sulfur. And Joseph Plum Martin, J.P. Martin, tells of all these experiences. But the reason that they did it, of course, was the threat had come, the information, the intelligence had come to them that that was what Britain was contemplating doing, was infecting the colonies with smallpox in a massive way through the slave population. They wanted to win that war, and they wanted this gin called the United States as bad as Rome wanted England several centuries before. And they would have done anything to get it. And they knew the possibilities because the colonies had opened up the wilderness, and they knew the great wealth that lay beyond the Alleghenies. They knew of the farmland in Ohio and Indiana, and they knew of the fertility of Kentucky, and people were just waiting to pour in. They were trying to stop them from pouring in because they wanted control of the Western, what they called the Far West at that time, and they didn't yet have control of it. And one of the complaints under Declaration of 76 was that the Parliament, the King, were barring them from populating new lands. They wouldn't let them go into new lands that belonged to their colonies by charter that had been given to them. So, but the smallpox threat was a real threat of germ warfare. Are we so foolish as to believe in our own day that those who wish to destroy us aren't contemplating the same things, only by more sophistication with more knowledge we have now of how to do it? Are we so foolish as to ignore the Muskegee experiment when they took black men, and infected them purposely with syphilis, just like a bunch of Nazis, to see what it would do to them? And that's happened within our memories. Are we so foolish to believe that those things aren't going on now? And are we foolish to believe that those experiments aren't going on in our VA hospitals, among our military men, in our federal prisons and state prisons? They're going on. And I have it on good information from more directions than one. So we should be aware of that and be wary and alert to the possibility. Thanks.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Hey, Gerard, you want to take the controls here? Gerard, you with us?
Yes.
You want to take the controls here?
My mute button is getting farther away each time.
Yeah, move it a little closer.
Hang, okay.
Hey, anybody want to get into the queue? Star 6, there's only a couple people in there. So, all right, you'll have to hit the button for the next caller.
Okay, I'll do that. Okay, it's almost 11. Here we go. Next question. We got Colorado Ollie. What's going on, Ollie?
Hello, everybody. You know, I firmly believe that Trump was taken office due to some spiritual reasons. With other things that are happening in the world right now, Brexit, the big animosity towards the UN, the exposure of Soros, how he's paying the protesters and this and that, I'm getting more and more of a feeling that we're entering into the big battle between the evil that has gripped this planet for the last 300 years or so, the Freemasons, the Skull and Bones, the Globalists, and others. And I would like Brent's spiritual sense and the spiritual sense of the panel. What's your spiritual sense on what's really going on at this time in history?
Gerard, are you there?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Did you want to take a crack at that first?
Well, I'll just give my own personal opinion, you know, as far as my feelings go, and what my knowledge is and the readings that I've done. It seems that these things that were written about and prophesized do seem to be coming together because history repeats itself, and very often you can see these older stories repeating themselves as they are now. However, this is like a time of no other, as from what I can see, because of the scope of it and how it's worldwide and with the communications and all. And I know in the Bible, you know, it says, "Do you not? You will judge angels." And he talks about slaying Leviathan in that day and the judgment of nations. Well, the judgment of nations cannot take place in eternity; it has to take place in time. So I don't know for sure, but it certainly feels to me like we're in that time, in that season. And that's all I can go by. You know, he says, how do you know? He says, well, you know, spring's coming when you see the buds on the trees. And so there is a certain natural feeling and knowledge that men should have that, you know. You know, God's people are never taken unawares. It's only the people that don't pay attention, that don't believe. They're the ones that are caught by surprise. They're the ones the thief in the night gets, you know. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, you can't wake up dead one morning. That happens all the time. But I'm talking about just in the grander things in society. You know, the writing's always on the wall, and somebody needs to interpret that writing. And if you know these things, then you know them in your heart. And so in my heart, I feel that we're in that time in that season. That's my personal opinion on that anyway.
By the way, if you wake up dead one morning, it must be that you're waking up on the other side.
Well, look, I just figured you never. And to me, I believe in the hereafter, so I'm never gonna not wake up. I'm waking up either way. Okay.
Yeah, I think we are absolutely, no doubt in my mind or heart, standing on the brink, and the judgment of God is waking up. It's going to sleep no longer, and how that's going to come about, I think it's going to be within the next year. And you know, I don't know how it's going to come about. I can only take guesses on that. But we're here at that point in time. I know people have been talking about that for a long time. I became very much aware of the fact that we're end times. Goodness, I'm trying to think what years it was. I think it was in the 80s. And I became very conscious of the fact that we're definitely end times. And a lot of people were looking, you know, for the signs, what was going on, and I myself included, and I embarked on a study in Revelation, which continues to this very day, and I can see, you know, God has been preparing the world for judgment even before that. As a matter of fact, I in my studies, I've come to the conclusion since 1948. The world is being prepared for judgment, and that's when Israel became a nation, and there was a 40-year period, which brings us to 1988. But that 40-year period that came and went is really a judgment upon Israel. You know, are they going to turn towards Jehovah again or not? And ultimately, and there's a big change, of course, that took place in the Middle East, but. There's a lot of things. I see it more today than I ever have, and we're standing on the brink is all I can say. So, Brent, if you want to pipe in.
Well, yeah, thanks, John and Gerard. There are two options each of us have in the midst of this madness. Of course, God's always working his purposes. That's never stopped. And it's our job in the midst of this, whether we understand or not, and we will not understand everything, is to get with the program. Get with the program, what does that mean? That means do what he tells you to do. Do what he tells you to do, but that takes a little bit of effort. My remedy to the problem of all this end times events, and they're without question happening, what's my job in the midst of all this? My job is to do what he tells me to do, when he tells me to do it. I have two choices, either do that or do nothing. I heard this a long time ago. I heard it once. The fellow spoke it clearly, and for some reason it struck me. It was so catchy, and I've never forgot it, and it goes like this. I get up in the morning. I dust off my wits. I pick up the paper, and I read the obits. If my name is missing, I know I'm not dead. I eat a good breakfast and go back to bed. And a lot of people have that view of life. I see them a lot. They're just kind of being comfortable, just waiting for tomorrow and trying to keep up with not having any hassles, I suppose. But God has given us our marching orders. We're not to wait for an epiphany. The Jews seek for a sign. We're not to do that. That's what Jesus Christ said of his own people. We are not to seek for a sign, we are to obey. We have our marching orders. Help to pray. And pray and ask God to show you what He wants you to do, unless you look and read it, or learn the law of nature, the laws of nature of God. Then you don't have to ask so much. You have to ask about an application, and you're to be praying all to understand that. But let's get off the dime. Do what He tells us to do. It's much more fulfilling. It is the animating contest. Less, you're not doing what God tells you to do. Seek safety. Seek safety. That's what it says. You want safety? Either carry the flag or get out of the way. One of the, they say, lead, follow, or get out of the way. That's what my buddy old Max says. Lead, follow, or get out of the way. You'll get your own. So that's my duty. My duty is to safeguard and to do what He tells you to do. Every man a lawyer. Every man. Every woman. You are already, to some degree, make it the preoccupation of your life, your lifestyle. The laws of nature and the laws of nature of God, so you can safeguard them and do them. That's your job. That's your only job. And that sums up all of your job before God. And all the madness on the other side of the world doesn't change. By the way, you want to change what's going on the other side of the world? They've been saying since I was a child, the Middle East is a powder keg. Well, it always has been. It still is. I'm not over there. I don't suspect I'll go over there. I have no desire to go over there. But I can do what God wants me to do right here, right now, in this land He's given me, and it will affect the whole world. I believe that. I believe the Bible teaches it. If I concentrate on taking care of myself, take care of my family, like Noah, He didn't try to save the world, but He did save the whole human race by trying to take care of His family. Now, that's kind of my response to it. Kind of? Yeah, that's my response to it, John, Gerard.
Okay, thank you, Brent. That was good. Okay, Ollie, I guess you have the panel's feeling there. I hope that helps. I guess we put Ollie to sleep. No. I guess he's off of there. I'll go to the next caller.
He dropped off the mic. Just click on the next question. He dropped off the mic for some reason.
Okay. Very good. Next question. We've got a wireless caller. You've been unmuted. Give me your name and your state, please.
Hi, this is Peter, Hudson Valley, New York.
Hey,
I'd like to give a big thank you to Ella Sturr, who gave us great accolades in an interview that I heard today. She was interviewing Kevin Annette of the ITCCS, which is a common law Canadian project that he's been involved, Nobel Prize nominee. But thank you, Ella, for the fantastic things you've said about National Liberty Alliance. And hopefully we can hear from you and maybe get some interviews on your show. But she gave us great accolades. I heard the interview at, it was galacticconnection.com, and it was a Kevin Annette interview, if anybody wants to get that connection. And again, a big thank you to her. She understands us. And it was promoting us. So thank you again. That's really all I needed to say tonight.
Thank you, Peter. Appreciate that. Okay, we got Eric up next. Go ahead, Eric. You're unmuted.
Okay, gosh. Thanks for having me again. Brent, you mentioned you were discussing atheism or atheists, and you said... I was looking for it in the past recordings. I even have notes on it. I still couldn't find it. So could you tell me where you had mentioned in the Bible that everyone knows the Godhead, and you were saying that you can stuff it down with so much evil that you can try not to see it, but everyone knows the Godhead. And then also, if you please, can you talk more about what a liberal arts education was initially, originally, and what it really should be. Thank you.
Okay, everyone knows atheism, said Bacon, is maybe on the tongue, but it's never in the heart. All men know Romans chapter 1. That's where the Bible says that. Paul the Apostle writing to the Christian folk at Rome, and that's cesspool. He said, all men know the Godhead. It's obvious to them. He says, by the way, that word God translated Godhead there, it's the Bible. It's very much like the Greek word for God, theos, but I think it has a tau in it. It's just a little different. And what it means, of course, is referring to the persons of the Godhead. It's a statement of what people came to call the Trinity, although that word's not in the Bible either. I understand that. Well, that's where I found it, and the truth is buried in unrighteousness, it says there also. It's our job to get it out. Serial law is adversarial. That means we fight. We go into court and fight. They don't do that in South America when they go to tribunals. The judge who isn't a lawyer, servant of the civil service ranks, GPS or GS or GS rating, that's what they call it in federal employment. And they don't fight, they have inquisitions. That's why torture is such a common part of the law of the city all around the world, and that's why torture has never been a part of our common law, because we are adversarial, not inquisitorial fundamentally. You know, already I got to talking about that, thinking what I was going to say. What was the second part of the question? The second question?
What a liberal arts education would initially, oh, yeah. What it really was.
Well, it came about, the idea had always been around. There was nothing new, but the fellow that made it famous was a fellow by the name of Augustine. He lived about 400 A.D. He was a bishop in northern Africa, and he became the foundation. Martin Luther was an Augustinian monk, and so Martin Luther had read his writings, knew them well, and that's why the Reformation occurred, because of this fellow named Augustine. He believed that the Bible was a product of the church, unlike Rome, who said the church, or no, rather the other way around. He believed the church was the product of the Bible, unlike Rome, who said the Bible is the product of the church. And many other fundamental things that Augustine articulated very well. You can get his writings, by the way. It comes in two big volumes, the writings of Augustine. By the way, he has also a book called his Confessions. And the way you can know, somebody told me once, it's true, the way you can know, well, you don't have to remember what sins Augustine committed before his conversion at age 32. Because there weren't any sins he did not commit, and he catalogs them for you when you read his Confessions. But at age 32, he was a wealthy fellow, pampered. He was a teacher of rhetoric, and he was living high and wide, had a lot of girls, a lot of booze, and he thought he was coming up in the Roman world. And he was in the garden, and he had a copy of the book of Ephesians. And in those days, they still read the Greek tongue, some places he did. And he said, something just said to him, why don't you read the darn thing? He'd had it for a long time and never read it. Big fancy professor that he was and all. And he read it. And it was a rather obscure verse. I forget which one it was, but it gripped him. Gripped him hard. His mother, I just remember her name, but he said later that she had prayed for him for a long, long time. She's a Christian woman. And so I say that because the prayers of a mother, he said, are very important. And don't faint in praying for your children. Don't faint. He said, if anybody would have fainted, it had been over me, things I was doing. But anyway, Augustine, some people call him, I think you say it either way, I suppose. He was the one that came up with the idea of people call a liberal arts education. He didn't come up with the idea. He was just articulating what had been ancient in God's mind and the Bible, it seems. But what he said was this, to put in his words. He said, I can read and understand most everything I read. I can say most everything I want to think, or I think I want. I can say most of what I think. I can understand most of what other people say to me, and I can see reading, writing, listening, speaking. I can speak most. Well, that's what it came down to. He could read, write, listen, and speak. In other words, the arts of language. The arts of language. And he said, these are the arts of freedom. The arts for free men. And remember, that day, put it in context, in the Roman Empire, one half of the population in some places, one half of the population, owned the other half. In other words, it was half slave and half free, one half owning the other half. And so there were two kinds of education in the Roman Empire, the education for slaves and the education for freemen. The education for slaves was called, I forget the Latin term, but it was an education for slaves. Let's leave it in English. We don't know Latin anyway. I just play with it. But it was an education to teach a person to obey, to teach a person to serve another, to obey another man, to not exercise discretion. None. But only to do what you're told and never act without permission. Well, there's a whole art. There was a whole art that had built up around that. Well, the free man had an education to exercise discretion. That means he has an education to make choices. That means he has choices. That means he makes his own choices. That means he lives with his choices. That means he sharpens his discretion. The Bible teaches that that's what God's people are freed to do. Every one of them. Every one of them. Whether slave or free, whether bond or free, male or female. Everyone is to sharpen their discretion. Paul says that. And he references all the classes of people there in Galatians. And that means that you're sharpening your discretion using the law of God, the will of God, the expression of his desire, which is the laws of nature and the laws of nature of God. The laws of nature have to do with process. The laws of nature of God have to do with substance. But the education for a free man, and if you want to be a free man, you want to enjoy your freedom, learn the arts of language. That's what Augustine. He said, because it's important, because God governs with words. Words. Not everybody can read, and that's been true until very recently and still true in a lot of the world. That's why the Bible doesn't say faith comes by reading. It says faith comes by hearing. The most fundamental creed known to man is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one Lord. Hear, the verb is hear. So the arts of language, and of course Augustine, he got this from the calculus of his study of the Bible, and he was no average student of the Bible. Read his writings, and you understand that he got it, and he worked hard to get it. He said a lot of things, by the way, that he'd drawn from the Bible, and articulated them so well. That's why people said and say now that study such things that throughout the history, since the days of Jesus Christ, there are just a half a dozen solid stepping stones. Of course, you can start with men like Paul the Apostle, John and James and Peter. But then you come a few centuries, and there are some stepping stones, but none as solid around 400 A.D. as Augustine. And then you have to make a long stride after Augustine to get to men like Wycliffe about the year 1370. There's not much in between. A lot of thinking goes on. A lot of Aristotelian Greek and Greek, Hellenistic Greek Roman thinking, logic. But there were no great men, no great thinkers, just thinkers, articulate thinkers, but they weren't focused on fact. They were focused on logic. You get to Wycliffe, and he puts it together, and he says the facts of the matter must govern. And then from Wycliffe to the Reformers are solid stepping stones, and up till today. I don't know who they'd be now. But Augustine was one of those great solid stepping stones, not to say he didn't have problems. He did. He thought prostitution was a good idea for the city of Rome. I don't know why he said that. Haven't quite figured it all out, but culture in his day had something to do with it, but for sure, the Bible didn't have anything to do with that statement. But not to take away from what he has given us in articulating, showing how the Bible makes sense and not nonsense, but he was the one that gave us the idea. of an education for freedom as opposed to an education for slavery. And I advise people, if you want to really have an education, forget the Ivy League schools. Forget all the Greek and Roman and, as they call it, Western philosophy. Forget it. Forget it. Learn the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. That's available to everybody, and very few people take advantage of it. David said in the Psalms, David, King David of Israel, he said, I know more than all of my teachers. And then he gives the reason. Because I ruminate on thy law, your law. I think about God's will and how he's expressed it. Therefore, and I found that to be true of a lot of men I've known that didn't go to formal education, immediately my father. He didn't go to high school. I still say he's smarter than I am, smartest man I ever met. And I am what I am, and I think what I think because of him. I'm interested in what I believe to be truth because he was interested in it. So don't belittle yourself. Don't short sell yourself. God makes you safe so that you can learn, so you can truly be an educated man or woman. Take advantage of what he's given you. And take advantage of the teachers he's sent to teach us all. But learn the laws of nature, unwritten in creation, and the laws of nature's God, written in the Bible, and you'll have that true education. Read an Encyclopedia Britannica, it won't give it to you. Oh, you learn a lot. Like the Bible says, ever learning, never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. I hope that helps.
No, it does. It really does. And, as testament to that, just real quick, and I really appreciate it, you were saying that freedom led to prosperity for us, and they let it get out of hand in England, and they asked the third in the line of their kings, King George, to get a handle on it, what they let get out of control. I think it was on Thursday night call, Gerard was mentioning how, and I didn't know this, but Gerard was mentioning how Putin was saying that Obama had mentioned that, has all these new ideas about basically socialist or communist ideas, but Putin was like, look, we got 80 years of this stuff, 80 years of proof and evidence to show that this stuff doesn't work, but it's amazing that the intelligentsia keeps coming up with the same old ideas and they're calling them brand new. And just as testament to that, to forget the Ivy Leagues, just as a matter of, I was going through something, I was trying to find something on cooking, and just listen to this, something called mise en place, everything in its place. And so I look at the Wikipedia thing, and it says, the term has also been used outside of cooking. Psychologist Weisberg et al. Used the phrase to refer to how one's stance towards a given environment places constraints on what one feels able to do within that environment, and how these assessments and predispositions impact the process of preparing to act. They used the term in a study of how a school became safer after security measures like metal detectors and bars on the windows were removed, leading to the unexpected outcome. And then the abstract says, a school became safer after security measures were removed. Anyway, I think it's just testament to what you were just saying. It's like the intelligentsia, they have so much knowledge, and yet they seem to keep having to learn the same thing over and over. And if you just went to the Bible, I'm just waking up to that myself. But anyway, I just thought that was interesting. I came across it. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
I appreciate the question. I wake up to it every day. It's fresh as the morning, the whole idea. And I don't think it'll ever stop. Hadn't yet.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Eric.
Oh, my pleasure.
And by the way, I guess that particular COS thing was able to capture that, and it's up there. That call that you said, did you tape that? And I didn't tape it, but Jan did catch it. And so.
Oh, excellent. Your wonderful rant. Okay, good. I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah.
Thank you for telling it.
It's called Gerard's Rant. Just look for Gerard's Rant at the very bottom of the list.
Well, excellent. I happen to like John from Illinois, who like bolstered that and added some stuff to it. That was pretty good. That was a good call. So
thank you.
Good. You're welcome. You know, and I just want to say something in heading off here, because we're almost done and we don't have any more people in the queue. I just wanted to say for a couple of minutes that, you know, I've been spending more time with my local fire department, as I'm a lifetime member. And in my mind, they have all the marks and are doing the things of a militia already. They just don't know it. They need some education to that fact. But they are first responders, and most of them all, you know, are hunters, and they have guns, and they're very proficient. So it's just a no-brainer for me to start with my fire department. You know, they're all a bunch of good guys, and, you know, we're like brothers. And so it's much easier to talk to those guys and expound upon stuff. So, you know, a couple of them are police officers. They come from all walks of life, you know, just as most of us do in volunteer work. But one of the guys who's a police officer, and he had such a police head on him, and I like him. I know him a long time. And he's been training and doing part-time police work and that, and I've seen a certain change in him. But he's been very disillusioned now with the SAFE Act and all this stuff. And he was lamenting about, oh, now they're gonna make us renew our permits. The lifetime permits are 5 years, and we got to sign up with the state police, and they're gonna take it away from the sheriff. And these are all things I've been ranting about, kind of, you know. But his thing was is that, oh, we got a sheriff that said that he's not going to enforce that in his county. He says, but, you know, if you don't sign it and you leave his county, then they'll arrest you. The state police will arrest you and the minute you leave. So that's not going to work. And I said, well, you know, the fact that we have a sheriff that stands up, and I said, and right now we have a president that wants to reinstitute the Constitution. I said, we can fix it. Oh, no, we can't fix it. It's impossible. He said, look, we live over here. He says, and no matter what we do, we got 9 million people down there in the city that outvote us. I said, you don't understand. I said, you don't need 9 million people or any number of people. I said, you need a couple of brave officials to stand up, because the things we're talking about have nothing to do with voting. It has nothing to do with a popularity contest. I told him, I said, these are the fundamental principles that our nation are built on. I said, you give me a good executive, you give me a good judge, you give me a couple of people, and you give me my militia, and I said, we can straighten everything out, because there's nothing to talk about. The Constitution cannot be changed by just a vote, and you can't diminish it. And every time he threw something at me to stop me and tell me how locked down we are and what a slave, and what he was revealing is what a slave he's become in his thinking, because he was narrowing and making things look very bleak, which in his mind they are, but they're really not, because he hasn't picked his head up against above the rut that he's dug for himself, that they've dug for him. He hasn't lifted his head up to understand what true freedom is, and how you don't need an army of people, you just need a couple of brave men to stand up and become those leaders. And I told them, I said, you know, once you get a few people standing up, especially you got a good sheriff, we need to support him, all the other leaders will raise their head, all the ones that have been afraid to say anything because they didn't think that their constituents would back them. I said, this is an exciting time. We need to get together. Oh, they'll do this and they'll do that. I said, no, they won't. I said, they'll only do, you're empowering them by your talk of saying what they're going to do to you if you do this. Look, that's why this is an exciting time. And that's why we need to stand on our principles. And that's what Brent was talking about earlier. It's a matter of doing those things that you know you're supposed to be doing, and have the convictions to do them. And when you do that, other people will step into line. You'll give them the courage. And especially those officials that took an oath to those principles that are supposed to be standing on that oath, that have forgotten how to do that. And I reminded him, I said, you look at, you are working for a corporate police force, a private corporation that is really not under the Constitution. I said, but I bet you took an oath of office. I bet you took an oath to the Constitution, didn't you? And he said, yes. And I said, well, now That's your marching order right there. That's your first order, because that oath trumps anything else that they tell you. And when they give you an unlawful order, your first responsibility is to obey that oath to the Constitution, because that's what makes this country a great country, that you follow those laws under God, not under some man. So anyway, that's what's going on today. This is why we need to open our mouths, even though you might feel funny or not popular or whatever. You know, people were amazed in there, because I don't say a whole lot, but that I was able to trump everything he said with a fundamental answer. So when you learn the fundamental principles, you don't have to worry about what you're going to say or what you're going to do, because the answers will just flow. They'll just flow out. I can't talk. Right. I'm I got some noise in the background here. That's right. Firefighters' job is to save life and property. And you know, he's saying police protect and serve, but that's if they're serving the people, not a private police force. Anyway. Anyway, that's my thoughts on that. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
Okay, we got a caller. Who's next here? Oh, we got Jeremiah in the queue. Go ahead, Jeremiah. Are you there? Are you there, Eric? Hello, you've been unmuted. Well, that's the last person in the queue. So, anybody wants to get in, we have a few more minutes, or we could close up early. Maybe my mic has stopped working. I don't know. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you just fine, Gerard.
Yeah, okay. I guess that's the end of the queue then, because nobody else is there. So I don't know if anybody else has anything. It's almost 11:30. This is some kind of a record. We never finish at 11:30, do we?
Never before.
Well, that's special. So if nobody has anything else, I guess we can shut down. You there, John? Or did you go to sleep? We let him go to bed early. We had mercy on him tonight. Okay, we have Georgia Dennis. Go ahead, Georgia. You've been unmuted. Are you there? Go ahead, Harley. You're unmuted. Hello? Something must be wrong with my cue here.
Can you hear me now?
Now I can hear you. Go ahead.
All right. Hey, so how you doing?
Good, good. What's going on there? I haven't heard from you in a while.
Yeah, I just was taking a little psychic break. I'd been pretty intense up until, you know, getting that decision, and now I'm regrouping. And so I was going to ask questions about other people working on mortgages, and so it's interesting that we're having a special call tomorrow at 8. And I was also wondering if any of the people who had stuff already processed, like I did with Linda, might be into this new case. You know, because I think there was a formal thing about how my situation was a crime against me, and it was sent to the sheriff. So, sheriff was named. It wasn't sent to any court on my behalf, I don't think.
Oh, yeah. No, in other words, I think we prepared a letter to the sheriff, right?
Yep.
and basically laid out what his duties were, which in your case he didn't follow, did he?
Nope.
Yeah, so that's not a good thing, because that leaves him open for indictment now, doesn't it?
Yep.
Yeah, so these are things that we're going to have to sort out here in the next couple of months, you know. I think your sheriff is a torn man from the little bit
yeah.
I know about your, you know, he's a little weak. He wants to do the right thing, but he's got a lot of pressure on all sides, and he fell down on, in your case, kind of turned his face away, right? He did the Pontius Pilate thing, right? Give me all the water, let me wash my hands on
it. It was pretty much, you know, he had very little discretion, I think, and he knew they were going to set me up if they could, but he tried to help them not set me up as bad. I'm going to leave it at that in the public, because, you know, I could have taken this the criminal route. I could have, you know, done a lot of different things, shenanigans, but I really want to do the landed in federal court, have a co-attorney so I don't look like I'm just a silly person all there by myself. I have somebody else who believes in it and put maybe their reputation on the line. I really want him to be a common law, non-bar lawyer, but somebody there, and I would present all these situations that were created by the slander and the bad will and the bad dealings of the bar lawyers, the confiscation crew for the bank. I want to lay it at their feet and look what position they put all these, sheriffs and even state police in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my strategy, and I just also wanted to know if it was one of the cases listed that you guys are presenting in this mass case or not.
And I don't know if there's a laundry list
of us to check it actually, you know, other than anecdotally by a category it might fall in.
Yeah, I don't know how that we listed each case. I mean, like John says, we have all the paperwork that we did that they didn't answer. And those will be answered first, at least with us, you know what I mean, when we get the opportunity to do that. You know, and I can only hope that once they, you know, Harley, the whole thing is them recognizing the fact that the people can come into the court of record, where the judge is a magistrate, and you have a true jury of your peers. You see, this is what we're missing, and this is what you don't get, and this is why you have robo-signing and all this other unlawful, crazy stuff going on, because, you know, they do a little bit, and they do a little bit more, and they get money hungry, and they get away with it, and they do more, and pretty soon you got this big orgy of stuff going on, of theft. And of
well,
you.
Exactly, and then it's mopped up by the fact that they anticipated the whole bubble crunch, and then they put in extra legislation to grease the wheels, because they said, oh, good grief, you know, the courts could get bogged down with people trying to get, you know, retain their property or get their rights. So, you know, but here's my question that comes up is, and this is just naivete on my part, but if you're in federal district court, and there are two, I suspect, for north and south in Vermont, right? Is that a place where people regularly get a jury trial? And can I get a jury trial over civil?
Well, it's the Constitution. You can demand it. Absolutely. Look at you. If it's over $20, buddy. I mean, they may not be following that, but that's the law. And so,
right, because that's the only way I want to do it, Gerard. But I want to hear not what in principle it should be, but what seems to be happening. And if Brent's there, he can answer this too. But, you know, what tends to be happening, and am I going to be able to push for a jury trial over my property and my damages to my reputation and my pain and suffering and all of these things?
Well, you know, when you go in when you go in appealing the higher court to straighten out the lower court, the judge does have the authority to give them an order to fix you. I mean, he doesn't need a jury to do that. It depends on how you go in. You know what I mean? If he's the guy sitting there as the tribunal, I mean, that's mostly equity, and this is kind of equity, except for they pushed it into the criminal realm. But when they set you up the way that they did, so that is a good question, and I think it's according to the way you write your case too. Like we went.
If I go in though, and if I submit Gerard, if I go in and say, okay, I'll be on the jurisdiction of yet another, you know, albeit federal, but still another bar attorney who does not want precedent in case law of some stupid destitute, you know, disabled farmer getting his property back because it was stolen under undue process and false use of legal, you know, instruments and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do I make sure that as I go in, I am stanced to only accept, you know, trial by jury? Because I think this is exceedingly, you know, jury sympathetic stuff. This is not judge sympathetic stuff, if there's such a category.
Yeah, I don't know that they're going to give you a jury. I mean, you usually ask for a jury. I mean, we don't ask for a jury. You know, when you go in a court of record, you are the jurist, and unless there's another party and they ask for a jury, then they have to have a jury. But you know, if you go in letting the judge be the chancellor, so to speak, then it's his decision. And most, unless you have to stumble upon a judge that has the wherewithal to stand behind the Constitution, you're not going to do well. You know what I mean? I mean, right now the mood is getting better especially as we push our case through. They're going to be more apt. I think there's going to come a point when they're going to look for constitutional cases like yours to rule for, so that they can say, well, look what I did for Harley. You know what I mean? I mean, you can hope for that. I mean, as things get moving and there starts to be a house cleaning, they're going to jump over each other's backs trying to be the first one to do the right thing. That's my hope. You know,
well, listen, I'm trying to be effective in like the next year, you know, and get this property back before some Nimrods develop it. You know, it's gorgeous property for McMansion.
I think your timing is perfect, to tell you the truth.
And so I want to get in on a technicality that's going to win, like that wins regularly. And I think one of them is under false representation. I have it so obvious that the malpractice that this lawyer inflicted on me, and then the other court, the one that actually pulls the trigger. See, the bankruptcy court doesn't really do anything themselves. They just make the county court destroy you. And so they made the county court do the work of ripping my title away. You know, but it's all under the auspices that I was represented when I wasn't. I wasn't represented at all in regular county court. I was only represented to a very limited degree in that corporate bankruptcy level. So they use it, they use the language, and you use the sort of power relationship, so to speak, between the two courts to their advantage at every level.
And that's the disease right there that you just described. That's the disease. Look, in the tax cases, what do? They take the property in rem. You never get a day in court. They just take it. They convert the deed, and then they turn around and they give the sheriff an eviction notice like you're a scofflaw tenant. He doesn't know the difference when he's coming to kick you out. He doesn't know if it's a tax case or a tenant or, you know, a property they own. It's the same process that you had absolutely no due process in. And that's the case.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. My sheriff might be crazy as a fox, but his ass was nowhere near there on that day.
Yeah, well, he
knew. There was a note I left on my table. I said, it could be your house. It could be your bond. This, don't touch anything. And I know all those cops, state police, and sheriffs are all scared. Even the clerk who wrote this garbage out. And because, you know, there was never a warrant for my arrest. There was never even a courtesy phone call to say, Harley, you need to leave today. Because my sheriff knew. My sheriff had all my court documents about my Supreme Court challenge to this kangaroo court that kept rubber stamping for the bank. So, you know what I mean? This sheriff stayed well away. And then when I ask a FOIA request, Like the next day, he emailed me email chain. He was aching to give me some freaking evidence about how they colluded behind my back to arrest me. So if I can't get my property back in state level court, if I can't demand a jury trial to hear evidence impartially away from people who take secret oaths to foreign, you know, corporations, then I don't know if I'll ever get any justice in this world. So I want to make sure that I have every fighting chance to do something that's close to has been done in federal court, in one of the two federal courts in Vermont. And yeah, they're fairly constitutional. They're fairly stripped down and basic because they haven't developed as strangely. And maybe I have a good chance.
Well, I think you do. I think you do in the federal court. You just make sure the judge has something to hang his hat on, because what he's doing is he's slapping the lower court, basically. He's slapping all those lower people. Now, I don't know how your case went. I know somebody here that sued all those people that you're talking about. That he took everybody that touched his property, everybody that touched anything, and he threw them all in a suit. And let me tell you what, they were all death afraid of him. They wouldn't even go next to his place afterwards. But like here, they're so blatant, they bundle everybody together in the same index number even, so that they can do all their robo-signing all at once. Like you said, when you said, oh, we got to make new legislation because we could get bogged down. That's why they put that MREM thing in. You just made a connection for me of why they do that. Because they don't want to. They want to make sure that they can come in and do this one felt swoop thing and have clean title, because people don't like to go and bid on something that Harley can get back if he wants. You know, it used to be, there was a long, long redemption period on property. You can come back in some states 6 years later and redeem it. Of course, you had to pay any improvements. If somebody made improvements, you'd have to pay the improvements and legal fees to get it back. And most people wouldn't do that, because the reason they lost it in the first place is they were sick. They didn't have money. You know what I'm saying? So they were on the skids to begin with. And they know that people that are in a situation where they're having trouble are not going to come back after them, and that's why they're so arrogant, because nobody ever comes back after them. And I, if I can make any kind of prediction at all, if you write a good case and you put it in that federal court, they might come back and say, look, we want to settle out of court. That's probably what will happen. They will not let you set precedent. They will. The reason you can't find cases is because they make settlements and have people sign non-disclosure agreements. Believe me.
Oh, and absolutely. You know, and once something's been tainted by the bankruptcy court or the, you know, county court, you know, lists are going bad, even though, you know, I made very good note in my final objection to my criminal thing, and the prosecutor disavowed information in the whole thing, just let the whole thing go without the judge even touching it. But I made very clear, and it's all registered on the record, all filed and stamped, that I still hold silent title. And the reason I was still there is that nobody ever showed me anything different. And so my point to myself these days is, how brave am I? If I went back there and camped on that land and somebody tried to come back and arrest me the same way for being on it, could it hold up? Well, I just got off for being there supposedly illegally. But that's their opinion of illegal. Nobody ever showed me that I, you know, that they had constitutionally taken and changed my title. I've got a quit clean deed from the last guy who owned it outright.
Yeah, and that is powerful, but, you know, it'll be a whole lot easier to take that course if you had a sheriff that you knew would stand behind you now, wouldn't it?
Well, after everything he's been through now, see, just after a few emails, a call to the guy who runs the state police of Vermont, and a couple of interesting conversations about constitutional law, somehow he made an appointment, let me come down and pick all my stuff up, regardless of the fact that there was an order at the court that said I wasn't supposed to go anywhere near, you know, anything of the kind. So I guess he wasn't too worried about me, even though there's, you know, restraining orders from me trying to contact him.
No, I think he's more worried about you than he's worried about them, is to put their shoe on the right foot. In other words, he knows that Harley knows how to articulate himself, and he knows how to write papers. And these Dumkos that are doing this, they're just going through the motions of a job, and they don't even understand the inner workings of what they're doing. You know, part of the reason that this abuse goes on is because they keep everybody dumbed down and compartmentalized,
exactly,
so that they don't see the big picture. And this guy's just doing this job. Just like you said, they're splitting it up between a bankruptcy court and a county court and this one and this sheriff and the state police. And you got all these different departments, and one hand doesn't know what the other hand's doing. And so they all can sit there and feign, you know, ignorance. And that's what's going on. And hopefully that's what our case is going to stop. It's going to stop all the people going, I don't know. You know, just following orders didn't hold up in Nuremberg, did it?
Exactly.
It didn't work out. That didn't work out.
Law never hurt, never helps us. You know what I mean?
Right.
If you come into Vermont, you don't read that one sign that says it's illegal to take U-turns in Vermont, you still get the ticket.
Right. You mean I can't make a U-turn in Vermont?
Absolutely.
Even if I left a bathtub on or something?
Well, no, there's a method for that, and the madness is the same reason why you can almost tell how fast to drive on most Vermont roads, because of narrow and curvy. And there's always a driveway and always something around. You're supposed to back into traffic and then back off to the side of the road and then turn. So you're always facing in, and you're never, like, stuck doing a three-point turn, because it's always a curve, and there's somebody going to come around that curve and wham-bast you. So,
right.
And then the road's never wide enough for a full U-turn.
Gotcha.
It's Vermont.
Yeah, right.
And the speed limit is 50 almost every single place in the state, not 55.
Right.
And again, all the roads are designed that way. I drove for 4 years with no speedometer in a little truck, and I never got a ticket. So I was just used to everywhere, you know?
And really, that's the way it's supposed to be, isn't it? I mean, speed is a function of prudence. That's why you
exactly
see those tickets, speed and prudent. We don't need speed limits. Look, if the speed limit is 55 and the conditions say that you should be doing 30 because it's slippery out, or there's a parade going by or something like that, you can't justify yourself by saying, well, the sign said I should be doing 55, right? You
yeah
have to use it's a discretion. And that's one thing they don't want to let us have today, and that's discretion. They think we're too stupid to have discretion. They want a bunch of robots. And the trouble with robots is, if anything is out of the ordinary, a robot can't fix it, because it doesn't think. And that's what they want. Like Brent says, they don't want you to think. You know, you're not supposed to think. So,
well, and most people go straight from a word to an emotion, right? And so if you say Holocaust, or you say court, or you say any of these things, they get a very strong reaction, because they've had nothing but terrible experiences and horror shows, and they don't even understand that, for one thing, court is for you to stand up for your rights, so that you can go after these people who are, you know, destroying your rights. And there were six other Holocausts before the Holo hoax, and they were all worse, and that was a ploy that was exaggerated to cover it up. So, you know, words are just there to freak people out and turn them in an immediate direction, turn them away from new information, you know, or old information that's been hidden. Usually it's old information.
Right.
And this stuff about restoring our Constitution is germane. It's key. It's important to the whole world, you know. And I just want to do a damn good job for myself, get to my back to my happy place, either get restored or learn so much that it was worth it anyway. You know?
Right.
I'm
going to
be
right.
burnt. I'm burnt and singed and PTSD all over from it anyway. 18 years of my life, you know, stripped away, and now I'm worried about who else is going to abuse that land. And either way, I've taken a hit, so I'm in. I'm all in. You know?
Yeah, right. Right.
Anyway, I'll let whoever else might want to slip in here and say goodnight. I appreciate it.
Okay, well, we only got maybe 10 minutes left. So anyway, I don't know. There's other things I want to talk to you about. I'll have to call you after the call. There's a couple things I wanted to expand upon, you know, of what you're doing and maybe give you some ideas. But
yeah, that's awesome. You know,
and
we
look
could
at
talk tomorrow on Skype or something or whatever you want to do.
Yeah, I don't know what my schedule is going to be, but I'll try to catch you. You know, if you see me on or whatever, I'll see. If you're there, I'll give you a ring. But look, using the courts is patriotic because that's where you school them. Where do you school your elected officials? Guess what? You school them in the courts. They're not going to listen to you any other way.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go in there and you take them all in and you put all their names in and you mention them and you bring them into the case, real fast they become attentive. And I do believe that that's what we need to be, you know, that's what we failed to do in the past, you know, and you know, that's...
Well, there's several public officials who failed me in ways that I can document through emails and stuff leading up to this misunderstanding. And, I told the, you know, many levels I wasn't going after the lower people. I wasn't in this for vengeance and try to ruin careers. But I'll tell you, people at a decision-making level who chose to turn the other way because, oh, there might be a legal issue. Well, what do your lawmakers and people do? They make and enforce laws all friggin' day long on you. So you're going to turn and tell me that just because there's a tinge or a taint to something having a legal aspect to it, you can't even touch it with a 10-foot pole? Get out of my face, coward.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody's afraid of litigation, but they're certainly creating it. And you know, if everybody did like you did and pushed back and filled out papers and demanded jury trials and things like that, that would be enough to slow them down or stop them. I mean, we could get rid of traffic court if everybody just said, I'm innocent and I want a trial, they'd be done. They couldn't possibly handle the caseload. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it's ridiculous. And everybody's getting fed up with everything. I mean, this is certainly that time of and that season, you know? And I see it all over the place. You know, I do inspections on cars, and these old cars, they don't want to pass the emissions inspection. And New York State lets you do a 10-day temporary if it passes the safety, and the readiness monitors aren't ready to pass. They'll let you give the person a 10-day, you know, extension to drive the car because you need to drive the car so that it can check all its systems out. Well, on these old cars, 9 times out of 10, it takes more than 10 days. And if you don't get it on the highway and you don't run it a certain way, you're not going to do it in 20 days or 30 days. And once that 10 day is out, they have no provision for driving the car anymore. I've had customers that have taken their car off the road and re-registered them just to get another 10 days. Well, this one little old lady, she was fit to be tied, and she called up the attorney general, she called up this one, she called up that, and my state legislature calls the other day. I didn't know who it was. He says, this is the government. I said, who? This is the government. We got to get Mrs. So-and-so's car inspected. Well, he was so sorry he called me because the earful that I gave him was more than she gave him. And so he was trying to make it like she was a crazy old lady that didn't understand what she needed to do. And I said, contraire, she understands perfectly. What's happening is you don't understand, and the state doesn't understand. And I said, this is worse than Nazi Germany or communist Russia. I said, I'm a New York State registered repair shop and a state inspector, and I'm not allowed to drive this car to get it. I get a ticket for driving this car when the 10-day temporary is out. I said, how ridiculous is that? They give me no discretion at all. They give the people no discretion. I mean, this is grounds right there. We should have some kind of a revolution over that. This is your right to travel that they're infringing upon. And, you know, I've heard of 2 states already recently that have canned their inspection program, and one of them, which I think was New Hampshire, 2 years ago, it was canceled due to noncompliance. You see, when they put a law in and they can't get a compliance rate on it of a certain, when they get it reach a certain non-compliance rate, that's mm-hmm. better than the Supreme Court, because what that means is the people have spoken. It's a bad law, and they're supposed to repeal it. You know, that's another function of nullification that they don't teach and they never tell us about. You know, but the fact of the matter is if you got some kind of law out there that no that everybody's violating because it's ridiculous and it's a statute and it has nothing to do with, you know, an injured party such as murder or something like that, then guess what? The people don't like it, the people don't want it, you need to nullify it. And as far as New York State goes with their SAFE Act, they said anybody that's got one of these type of guns that we've identified as an assault rifle, which was a ridiculous, which was a misnomer, you need to register them. And then when after a year, we tried to get the records of who registered them, and they wouldn't give it. They had to go through a lawsuit to get the information of how many people actually registered. Now, they don't know how many of those guns are out there completely, but they do know, they do have a number of how many that were sold that they do know about. And guess what?
The ones that were sold new would have been automatically registered, but the legacy ones, it's anybody's guess.
No. The ones that they sold new were not automatically registered because there was no registration, but they know that those guns are out there. But they don't know where they are because you could have bought it new, and then you could have sold it or gave it away. But they know they're out there. You know
okay, I thought you were talking about people.
Look,
I just thought you meant
they did it. They did it ex facto. The gun was legal one day and it was illegal the next day. They made it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So they know that they sold.
But you're talking about
compliance
rates,
right?
I mean, you're talking about the point of like who would actually register them and how many people just didn't bother registering them.
Well, they know that they had so many sold before they needed. They know about these sales that happened in the state.
Right, I got that.
And they know that they're out there, and so they got a number there. But they don't know how many were brought in that they know nothing about. They never had anything on them, right? That were, like you said, were legacy. They know let's say they know that there's 3 million of those assault rifles that were sold in New York State. There could be another 3 million they don't know about, right? But out of the 3 million that they know about, they got less than a 0.05% registration rate. I think the people in
Atzel was waiting for the punchline.
That's the punchline. Look at they go. We need to repeal the SAFE Act. Repeal hell. You don't need to repeal it. It was unconstitutional from the beginning, and you don't need to fix it. You need to just get rid of it. It's nullified. Let's not talk repeal. You know. And then they said, oh well, a judge over here in the Sixth Circuit said that the magazine ban is unconstitutional. Now, this is coming from a local law enforcement official, and he said, but the judge over here in this circuit hasn't said that, so I wouldn't put any bullets in my gun over here. I said, do you realize what you just said, that this judge over here says it's unconstitutional, and this judge over here hasn't said it, so you think it's constitutional over there and unconstitutional over here? Does that make any sense at all? Do you understand what you're saying? See, we're taught to be such slaves. They think that they need, everybody thinks that they need to be told what to do. That's the problem.
Well, this is it. You tried to tell people a few years ago that we're the most well-regulated, you know, society on earth. And, you know, we share that with the English. We just, and the Indians loved that about English society, thought that made them sophisticated. So they even went more bonkers. And just look what's happening to them. They're so compliant, and they go along with these, like, currency disappearing. And, you know, they would turn up the heat faster on us if they could, and they can't. They just can't, you know. And, you know, this thing about, you know, a law that can't be followed brings all law into disrespect. Well, I think that's what they want, too, because they don't want you to be able to definitely prosecute, you know, full-on fraud that affects a ton of people or treason that affects your whole nation. They want to, you know, make this world of rampant relativism, you know.
Yeah, because they're the ones committing all the treason. That's why. That's why they don't want you. If you could really rest in the law, you know, they're making money and they'd crash and burn on that stuff, and they know it. You know, it's so there's two different standards there now, isn't there? You know, and in America, when they said to regulate, they meant make regular. They misconstrued it to regulate. In other words, Congress was supposed to make commerce regular through the state, not just regulate it for the sake of regulating it. You know what I mean? They've turned that on its head.
You know what I picked up on listening to last week's archive was that the feds, the only way they would manage to insinuate themselves yet again on the Oregon guys, if I heard right, was to say it had some effect on interstate commerce.
Boy, they're really digging deep, aren't they?
Well, you know, it's like this little fig leaf. It's like you just made the admission that everything else you do is pretty much overreach.
Right, right.
10th Amendment.
Yeah. Well, there we go. So anyway, I think we've gotten to that point, Harley. It's 12:01. Yeah. I heard the gong go. So thank you, everybody. Thank you, Harley. I'll be talking to you during the week sometime.
Yeah, I'd love to catch up and stuff and plot and strategize a little bit.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Thank you, everybody.
Yep.
Okay, we'll end with a song here, and thanks a lot for your support.
You are mine.